on One by Joe Weber, being performed by Tech Murdoch.
The Nimitz-class carrier plunged through foaming troughs, sending showers of cold spray over the bow as dawn began to light the gray sky. Lieutenant Commander Frank Stevens leaned closer to the radar plot in the Combat Information Center. The Hawkeye early warning aircraft had just informed him of unidentified bogies approaching the battleship. Stevens watched the radar blips approaching from the northeast on a direct course to the battle group. He strained harder to focus on the images displayed by the luminescent scope. The tension was stretching his nerves. Unidentified in this region meant Russian. Navigation, CIC, what is our position? Stevens requested through the intercom system. Sir, our present position is 70 nautical miles due north of Faroe Island, 210 miles below the Arctic Circle. Tango Fox, this is Stingray. The voice exploded from the overhead speakers. We have confirmation on the bogies. Appears to be two Russian backfire bombers. They're descending with a fighter escort of three, possibly four aircraft. Acknowledge.
Roger, Stingray, replied Stevens. We're launching ready CAP-1 at this time. Call gunfighter on button 7.
Okay, Tango Fox. Better have them move out. These guys are closing at the speed of heat.
The standby combat air patrol pilots, Doug Frogman Carnes, gunfighter 1, and Steve Hirschberger, along with their radar intercept officers Rick Bonicelli and Gordon Cavanaugh, scrambled into the rear cockpits of their respective jets. The fighter pilots and their RIOs racing to get airborne had no idea who or what the adversary might be. Their mission was to scramble off the carrier as quickly as possible, then confront the unknown Gomers. The deck-edge operator pressed the launch button. The Tomcat exploded down the catapult track in a thundering roar, helmets pressed back in head restraints. Breathing was impossible, even with masks supplying 100% oxygen. Eyeballs flattened, causing momentary tunnel vision and a graying out effect. The excruciating G-forces rendered the crew semi-conscious during the violent launch. The catapult stroke hurled the 70,000-pound fighter plane from 0 to 170 miles per hour in 2.5 seconds.
Good shot, Carnes said. Stingray, gunfighter, one up. Flight of 2, 6 missiles each, state 17.2.
Roger, gunfighter.
You got anything on the radar? Carnes queried Bonicelli.
Sorry, boss, the tube is down for the count, Bonicelli replied.
Hirsch, you and Gator have a lock, Carnes asked.
That's a firm, Frog.
Want us to take the lead? Replied Hirschberger, realizing the flight would rendezvous with the Soviet aircraft in 8 minutes.
Yeah, Hirsch, take the lead. Let's go combat spread, Carnes directed.
From the repeater television screen in CIC, Lieutenant Commander Stevens had watched the CAP Tomcats roar off the pitching deck. He lifted his phone handset and punched the code to connect him with the commanding officer.
Captain, this is Frank Stevens, the watch officer in CIC. We have a situation developing that I believe you need to be aware of.
All right, Frank, replied Linnemeyer. What's the problem?
Well, sir, we launched the CAP. They are intercepting two Russian backfire bombers and four escort fighters. We haven't had any
God damn it, Linnemeyer interrupted tersely. Go to general quarters, launch ready two CAP, and notify the battle group commander. I'll be in CIC in 5 minutes.
I've got a tally, Carnes radios to Hirschberger and Cavanaugh.
Carnes could see the Russian aircraft 7 miles ahead.
I've got the lead, Carnes radioed Hirschberger as he resumed command of the flight. Two, you fall in behind the shooters and we'll take the heavies, Carnes instructed his wingman.
Gunfighter two gently moved to a position behind and to the left of the Soviet fighters. Hirschberger never took his eyes off the MiGs as his thumb caressed the control stick firing button.
Just like in the movies, Cavanaugh said. These Ruskies are stubborn, Carnes reported to the Eisenhower's Combat Information Center. They keep turning into us a degree or two at a time. Now, with four shooters tagging along, this could turn into a real furball.
The F-14 flown by Carnes and Bonicelli inched closer to the huge, menacing bombers.
Okay, gunfighters, check switches safe, Carnes radioed his wingman.
Two's safe, responded Hirschberger as he slowly drifted back and forth behind the four MiG-29 fighters.
Colonel Estvan Torgovnik nervously watched the American fighter plane off his left wing as he deftly used his flight controls to swing the backfire bomber slowly toward the American fleet.
Ah, Comrade Colonel, you appear tentative. You must remember our orders.
The small man leaned closer to the pilot as he spoke.
Do not worry. The inept Americans will not interfere.
boasted Major Fulvio Vladka. An assumption, replied the command pilot. We have never tested the Americans in this manner. We cannot guess their response. This action, Comrade Major, is not within our defined operating doctrine. In addition, I have the responsibility of our sixth aircraft and the superior air crew to the... It is I who have responsibility for the success of this mission. You will obey the orders to probe the American defense reactions. Besides, Comrade Colonel, this operation, if successfully conducted, could see you achieve general officer status. Perhaps your own car and a Dhaka near your operational sector. Yes, Fulvio Fredrikovich, I realize the significance of this task, replied Torgovnik, thinking, when I am a general officer, I will crush this impudent bastard. Captain Linnemeyer rushed into CIC. What's the current status? The captain asked a distraught CIC officer. The CAP is rendezvoused with the Soviet aircraft. They are approaching the 110-mile mark, sir, responded Stevens. The ready-to CAP is airborne, closing on, should be joining Cap 1 in 2 minutes, he added nervously. Also, sir, we have a tanker airborne and a spare Viking on the number one cat. Two more 14s are ready. Stevens paused to look at his status boards. The escort ships are closing in, sir. No sub-activity detected at this time. Ivan is setting a new precedent, Admiral McKenna said to Captain Linnemeyer. Greg, they are obviously trying to provoke us, test our defenses and reactions. I'll get off a flash message to the commander-in-chief of the Atlantic Fleet and the NATO commander. We don't have a lot of time. You agree, Greg? Yes, sir. We'd better show some resolve if they break 50 miles. I concur. How do you think Sinclant will respond? The admiral asked. Order us to fire a warning shot, shoot a missile in front of the lead bomber at 50 nautical miles, and if they don't break off by 30, to blow their asses out of the sky, Linnemeyer responded. I hope so. We simply cannot, should not, knuckle under to those arrogant bastards. They're closing on our landing platform, Carnes said to his RIO, and I don't like it. Carnes gently banked his Tomcat into the Soviet aircraft as Bonicelli shot a dozen pictures of the menacing warplanes approaching the American battle group. Comrade Colonel, now is the time to execute our penetration of the American fleet, Major Vladka urged. Yes, I agree, Volvio Fredrikovich. The Soviet bomber pilot keyed his microphone. Prepare to alter course. As Carnes concentrated on maintaining position on the Soviet bombers, Animals 1 and 2 joined on Hershberger's F-14D. Gunfighter lead, Animal Flight is aboard. Looks like you have him cornered. Captain Vince Cangemi checked in with Carnes. Raj, Animal, back off about 300 yards and confirm guns off. Switch is safe, Carnes instructed the animals. That's a firm, off and safe, Cangemi answered. At that precise moment, the Russian bombers abruptly turned into the American fighters, forcing Carnes to spiral inward or risk collision. Reacting with remarkable dexterity, Carnes simultaneously rolled his fighter away from the bombers and radioed CIC. Tango Fox, Gunfighter 1, these crazy son of a bitches are making a run at the battle group, Carnes shouted. I need permission to fire. Roger, Gunfighter, stand by, Carnes waited uncomfortably. Gunfighter, Tango Fox, the staccato voice blurted. You have permission to fire a warning shot at 50 DME. If the Russians break 30 miles, shoot them down. Do you copy? Linnemeyer asked. Roger, Tango, Fox. Okay, Hirsch. You need to ease back on Animal's wing. The Tomcat slowly drifted behind the Russian formation. Animal's in place, Cangemi stated. He slowly dropped back into a good firing position, low and looking at the tailpipes of the Russian fighter planes. Gun 1 is moving up under Uncle Ivan's left wing. I want the friggin' son of a bitch to see me, Kearns radioed. Okay, Komradsky. Look over here, Kearns said. Torgovnik glanced briefly at the American fighter plane, wincing at the proximity of the crazy American. Comrade Major, he said, these Americans, we are pushing too hard. Nonsense, replied Vladka. They will not risk a confrontation unless we openly provoke them. We have not attempted to fly a multi-aircraft group over an American carrier before. Vladka smiled his most condescending smile. Do not worry, Colonel. All right, goddammit, Kearns said as his distant measuring equipment indicated 50 nautical miles from the Eisenhower. I'm moving out to the side. Everything is cooking. Here we go, Kearns stated as he gently pressed the right rudder and squeezed the firing button. The F-14 shuddered as the AIM 9mm Sidewinder heat-seeking missile flashed from under the right wing, accelerating with startling speed. "Fox 2!" yells Kern as he reduced power and rapidly dropped astern, glancing back to see what action the Russian fighters would take, if any. The MiG-29s immediately moved closer to the bombers. The MiG flight leader was bouncing all over the sky as his charges settled down from the shock. The six Soviet warplanes slowly turned in the direction of the Barents Sea as the four Tomcats escorted the intruders away from the battle group. "Nice work," the CO said to the pilots. "Stay with them until the 200 mark and RTB.
"Well, Comrade Major Vladka," Torgovnik said, "that should dispel the myth of American non-confrontational behavior." "It is not a myth, comrade. We have well-researched intelligence," Vladka blurted. "I assure you, Colonel Torgovnik, the Americans will be tested to the limit in the forthcoming days."
"Well, Greg, how about breakfast before it gets too cold?" Admiral McKenna asked Linnemeyer.
"Sure, I'm famished,"
the CO responded. As Linnemeyer and McKenna sat down, the CIC discreet phone rang. The Admiral answered the phone, frowned, and said, "I'll be there in a minute." The Admiral looked at Linnemeyer. "Damn it, Greg. The Viking has picked up two subs, both with Russian signatures. One is 12 miles off our port bow, and the other one is 7 miles astern." McKenna stood up. "Let's go back to the general quarters and find out what the hell is going on there." The Admiral's Irish temper was beginning to flare. The Navy blue limousine slowed to a smooth stop at the entrance to the JCS headquarters in the Pentagon building. Admiral Edward Robinson Chambers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, emerged. "Good morning, Admiral." Captain Mike Trenton, the Admiral's aide, greeted Chambers. "What the devil do you make of all this, Mike?" the Admiral asked.
"Sir, the information we have as of 30 minutes ago indicates a full court press by the Soviets," Trenton replied.
"Has the President been notified?" Chambers asked as he passed through the door being held open by Trenton.
"He is aware of some unusual events, but not the particulars, sir. The Chief of Staff has requested on behalf of the President a full briefing as soon as the Joint Chiefs convene."
"Good morning, comrades." General Secretary Viktor Pavlovich Zelenkov addressed the Central Committee members.
A murmur spread throughout the vast meeting hall. Now it was time to grapple with the multitude of problems facing the motherland and her leaders. It was time, as Zelenkov had stated so ferociously the previous evening, for a return to hardline Marxist-Leninist orientation. The Gorbachev Doctrine had not strengthened the Soviet economy or restructured Russian society.
"We have much to accomplish, my fellow countrymen," Zelenkov smiled. "I have important news for you, news that will change our country for the better, news that will revolutionize our motherland."
The Joint Chiefs sat down and opened the hastily prepared briefing folders. Admiral Chambers spoke first.
"Gentlemen, it would appear the new Russian boss is an expediter. Why, with all their internal problems, would Zelenkov choose to antagonize the U.S.? It is inexplicable why they would push us so soon. Zelenkov has been in power for less than 4 weeks."
General Forrest Milt Ridenour, U.S. Air Force Chief of Staff, spoke up.
"I believe the good comrade is trying to muscle us into a position of capitulation through confrontation. The man is in ragged health. Zelenkov knows he doesn't have a lot of time. He has to perform. His reputation and the future of his country is on the line. He must demonstrate to his supporters that he can bring the Americans to the bargaining table, that he can make us, through a thinly veiled threat of war, bow and acquiesce. We have a real problem on our hands."
The 3rd Fleet carrier and its battle group had received orders to steam at flank speed toward the Sea of Okhotsk. The 23,000-ton Vinson and her escort ships would join the 7th Fleet battle group to prowl the waters adjacent to Kamchatka Peninsula.
"We have seen an alarming and growing threat from the Russian sector in the past 4 days," Rear Admiral Thomas Brinkman said.
We assume it has to do with the political swing brought about by the untimely death of the former General Secretary. The commander glanced at his staff intelligence officer, Captain Jack Sinclair. I believe Jack can give us a better picture of the current situation. Jack?
The Russians are mobilizing their ground forces in the Eastern Bloc countries, and they have been moving their fighter air wings to forward operating bases west of the Urals.
Every operable sub has left the bases at Polyari and Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky. The waters we are currently traversing are crawling with Russian subs. What we don't know is why. The general consensus is this. The new regime is sending a strong signal to indicate they want to realign the Soviet and American power base. The Russians apparently believe they can achieve this result through intimidation and military presence. They are aware of our final link to the basic space defense system and is about to be launched aboard Columbia. The only leverage they have is the strength of their military, and apparently the newly formed powers believe it is their last recourse. So it's back to MAD, the Mutually Assured Destruction Doctrine, before we place them in a position of impotence with the SDI technology, Sinclair concluded. The space shuttle Columbia, waiting on launch pad 39B, was in the final process of being readied for flight to place the three SDI Space Defense Initiative satellites into orbit. The day and precise time of the scheduled launch were classified top secret, as was the sensitive cargo in the three sealed containers aboard the shuttle. The new chief of NASA, Rex Hayes, was standing at his office window.
Dr. Hayes, you have an urgent call on line two, the female voice sounded from his phone speaker.
The NASA boss punched line two.
Dr. Hayes?
Rex, Dave Miller.
Morning, Dave. What can I do for you?
Rex, I'm sure you've been following the Russian push-and-shove match the past couple of days.
Yes, I have.
Well, the powers that be think the Russians may try to take it out before we...
Take what out? Hayes interrupted.
The goddamn shuttle, that's what. Intelligence has confirmed three Russian subs lying off the coast in the direct line with the shuttle trajectory.
You're telling me the intelligence people believe the Russians may attempt to destroy Columbia on the ground or after the launch?
You got it. Even a possibility of covert troops, commandos, from a sub coming ashore and destroying the shuttle and surrounding facilities. Hell, they could be all over the place right now. Could have been picked up by a yacht, everyone in tourist civvies and roaming around the Cape this very minute.
Okay, Dave, what do you propose? Hayes asked.
Not much for your folks, Rex. Just be aware and alert everyone to the possibility of sabotage. The army is going to surround the complex and beef up security.
After Zelenkov had entrenched himself in the position of consummate power, the steps necessary to probe the Americans in preparation for a nuclear, chemical, and biological first strike against the United States were begun. The first step had already been completed. Russian bombers with fighter escorts had approached American battlegroups. The inner circle knew they could launch cruise missiles at the U.S. carriers from within 150 kilometers. Now Soviet submarines would pursue U.S. carrier groups, pressing closer than ever before to evaluate Russian first strike capabilities. The bomber and submarine probes had been carefully designed to appear as normal military operations under the new regime. If the secret plan leaked out, Zelenkov's power to launch a strike on a moment's notice, without question, would be stripped by the eight uninformed Politburo members. Zelenkov, now waiting patiently for the next step to take place, sinking the American submarine prowling the Sea of Okhotsk. Linnemeyer stepped into the Combat Information Center and was greeted by the senior petty officer of the watch.
Good evening, sir.
Evening. What's the picture at the present time?
The Kennedy is joining us. They're out of the med now, somewhere off Lisbon. The bad news is that we still have the two subs trailing along, and the Kiev is standing off about 105 miles. As you can see, sir, we've been steaming back and forth over the same course the past 6 hours.
What's the deck status?
Spotted for immediate CAP launch, sir. The pilots are in the cockpits. The Hummer is airborne, along with two Vikings and a tanker.
The skipper of the USS Tennessee, Captain Mark McConnell, had received orders to return to the battlegroup. He had been reconnoitering deep in the Sea of Okhotsk and was underway for the Constellation and her escort ships. 14 nautical miles inside Severo-Kurilsk, off the southern tip of Kamchatka Peninsula. The Tennessee had been intercepted by a Uniloy-class anti-submarine warfare ship. The American sub had been running at two-thirds speed at a depth of 200 feet, generating a loud acoustical signature when one of the Russian helos spotted it with a sonar buoy trailing in the water.
To exacerbate matters, two Soviet submarines were positioned between the Tennessee and the American battle group. They had been notified by the Russian anti-submarine ship of the exact position of the U.S. nuclear sub. The Russian nuclear-powered guided missile cruiser, Fruins, armed with SSN-19 anti-ship cruise missiles, was loitering 270 nautical miles east of Komondorsky Island. The Soviet ship was midway between the two American carrier groups operating in the northern Pacific waters. Admiral Yevgeny Bochkov had been in constant communication with the anti-submarine vessel Akhromiev, the Soviet ship pursuing the USS Tennessee. Fleet Admiral Vozogian had been very blunt in his orders to Bochka, orders apparently issued directly from the defense minister, spelling out the necessity to pressure the American forces at every opportunity. The word had been passed throughout the chain of command that the General Secretary was personally directing the operation. Senior sonar man Clay Booker concentrated on his sonar panel, waiting for the Russian ship to ping them again. Ping! Ping! There it was, closer this time. "They really got us bracketed, sir," Booker said quietly to Captain McConnell. The sub-skipper nodded. "Well, what do you think, Ken? Should we set a straight course for the group? It's been over an hour, and they haven't done anything but tail us." "No sense in trying to evade them. We can't go deep enough at this point. We can't outrun the choppers." "True. Might as well come to periscope depth. We need to alert the task force of our position and situation. We'd better request air cover back to the battle group. Communications. Stand by for a message to Constellation," McConnell ordered as he picked up the microphone to transmit his report to the American carrier. The sub leveled at 60 feet as McConnell prepared to send his message. "I sure hope the county is listening," McConnell said to his executive officer. "Yeah," Houston answered. "We are already overdue." The Udaloy-class anti-submarine ship was pacing the Tennessee at a distance of 6 kilometers. The ship's master, Captain Sorovchik, was listening to the crew of Akhromiev II as the helicopter circled the Tennessee. "Akhromiev II, the submarine is slowing, we think surfacing," the pilot said as he swept low over the Tennessee. "Keep the sub in sight," Sorovchik radioed Admiral Bochka. "Comrade Admiral, we believe the American is preparing to surface. A periscope was spotted moments ago," Sorovchik reported. Bochka responded immediately. "My orders, Captain, originated in the Kremlin. You must keep the submarine from surfacing until one of our subs is in position to torpedo the Americans. This must happen below the surface. No witnesses. Any surface action might be detectable by reconnaissance satellite or spy planes. Do you understand?" "Yes, Comrade Admiral," replied Sorovchik. "Akhromiev 1 and 2, this is Captain Sorovchik. Acknowledge." Both Russian pilots replied immediately. "Your orders are to keep the submarine totally submerged. No mast or periscope, nothing above the water. Comrade Captain, we are cleared to drop depth charges if any part of the submarine rises from the water. This is correct." The pilot of Akhromiev 2 armed his number one conventional HE depth charge pack and rolled into a dive toward the Tennessee. He purposely released the charge late. He had not been ordered to destroy the sub, only keep it below the surface. The depth charge smashed into the water 200 meters in front of the submarine. It was set to detonate at a depth of 150 meters and quickly sank below the Tennessee. "Hang on!" Chief Booker yelled across the control room. "The bastard just dropped one on us!" McConnell barked orders and radioed the Constellation. "We're being attacked! Tennessee, under attack!" McConnell repeated and tossed the microphone down. "Left full rudder, off full ahead!" McConnell shouted. "Rig for depth charges!" McConnell paused. "Shit!" The captain looked at Houston as the depth charge went off. Kaboom! The Tennessee shuddered violently. "Son of a bitch," Houston swore. "Take her to 300 feet. Rudder amidship," McConnell ordered. "Do you think the Connie heard us, skipper?" Houston asked as the Trident plunged toward the ocean floor. "Well, we'll know in a few minutes. I can't believe this," McConnell said. "If they drop anything else, we'll take out the goddamn ship. The helos will be as good as finished. They'll have to run for land or take a bath." The Combat Information Center had heard the radio transmission from the Tennessee. The last few words were garbled and had to be enhanced and repeated several times before the word attack was discernible. The task force commander aboard Constellation, Rear Admiral Benjamin Thompson, immediately launched the Combat Air Patrol. Admiral, your patch to sync pack is open, Thompson's aide said as he handed the Admiral a headset. Ben, this is Joe Lindsay. We've got a confrontation brewing here, sir, and I recommend we go on alert. Thompson paused. The Tennessee radioed she was under attack. How long ago? 9 minutes, Admiral. The CAP is airborne, 2 Tomcats, and we've got a Viking en route. 14s will be overhead. The Tennessee is approximately just 12 minutes, sir. Okay, Ben. Keep me informed. I will alert Washington. The 2 Grumman fighters and the Russian ASW ship and her Kamov helicopters locked on their radar scopes. They had been supersonic the past 11 minutes and were now slowing for a rendezvous with the Tennessee. Lieutenant Earl Mad Dog Hutchinson, the flight leader, radioed his wingman. Chuckles, you stay high and cover me. I'll get down low and slow, see what we have. It had been 17 minutes since the unprovoked depth charge attack. McConnell decided to have a look topside. Friendly aircraft should be in the vicinity by now, providing the Constellation had received his message, McConnell thought as he prepared to ascend. The Soviet ASW ship had detected the approaching American fighter planes on radar. Captain Sorovchik elected not to inform the Kamov Hilo pilots. His postulation required that everything remain status quo for a few more minutes. That would be enough time for one of their hunter-killer subs to be in position to destroy the intruding American submarine. Just a few more minutes. Periscope depth, Skipper. All ahead, slow. McConnell ordered, adjusting the periscope handles. McConnell raised the small attack periscope to a position 2 feet lower than normal. Waves crashed over the top of the viewing lens. McConnell raised the scope another foot. Able to see better, he swept the horizon in a quick 360-degree circle, then reversed his sweep 30 degrees. Damn! Dive! Dive! McConnell ordered as he slammed the handles into the periscope, already retreating from the overhead. Level at 400, McConnell barked. The Hilo, at least one of them, is still there. Don't know if he spotted the scope. The ship is approximately 5,000 yards off our port beam, he explained to his exec. See any of ours? Houston asked. No, McConnell said. Jesus, they're right on top of us. Mark, Houston said under his breath, I'm beginning to have a really bad feeling about this. The flight observer saw the telltale wake of the periscope as he glanced across the open water. Comrade Lieutenant, there. Yes, I see, Sergei. Starshy Lavrov responded as he armed his number 2 depth charge pack. Akromyev 2, the pilot radioed. The American has broken the surface. Commencing attack. The periscope had just descended beneath the water when the Kamov pilot dropped the 2nd depth charge. Depth charge! Booker shouted as everyone braced for the thundering shockwave. Kaboom! The Tennessee lurched sideways and rolled slightly before righting herself. Why are they so intent on keeping us submerged? McConnell asked Houston. Doesn't make sense unless they have something else in mind for us, Houston said. Like what? They either want to detain us until a boat full of press photographers arrives, or, Houston paused, they are waiting for a killer sub, Mark. The exec looked up at McConnell. They can't attack with a surface vessel. The risk of being caught by a recon plane or satellite is just too high. That leaves the job to an efficient hunter-killer. Nice and clean. You may be right, Ken. McConnell looked at his watch and continued. If my message didn't reach the Constellation, I didn't see any friendlies overhead. Then we're on our own. And being depth-charged. Give me a solution, McConnell ordered his exec. Aye, Skipper. Houston responded as he viewed the data input on the MK-117 fire control computer. The Tennessee's MK-48 torpedoes were the most powerful in the U.S. arsenal, wire-guided and capable of homing on a target with its own sonar. Solution, Skipper, Houston reported. Bearing 340, range is 5,400 feet, running time 4 minutes 5 seconds. Stand by the tubes, 3 and 4, McConnell ordered as he prepared to raise the main periscope. The torpedo tubes were flooded down and ready for launch. No one was breathing, not even blinking. The reality of the imminent assault on the Russian ship was registering. Up periscope, McConnell ordered as he gripped the hand controls and again swept the horizon through 360 degrees. Stopping on the Akromyev, McConnell visually and verbally confirmed the Soviet ASW ship. Fire 3, McConnell ordered. The Tennessee shuddered as the compressed air charge shoved the big MK-48 out the number 3 torpedo tube. 3 fired, sir. Fire 4, McConnell repeated as he slammed the handle upward and stepped back from the descending periscope. Another shudder. Fired 4, sir. Take her down. Right full rudder. All ahead flank, McConnell ordered the helmsman. Sonar, what do you have?
Boatfish running hot and true, sir. 2:55 to go on the first torpedo, skipper. Okay, let me... Depth charges, Booker interrupted. The Tennessee plunged ahead as every crew member grabbed for a handhold. The pilot of a Kromiev 1, Nicholas Chernoff, was growing weary from his 14-hour duty day. Suddenly, Chernoff thought his mind was playing tricks on him. Was that his box lunch on the ocean surface? Couldn't be. It was moving. Chernoff concentrated on the spot. A periscope. Observers, the sub is showing a periscope again, Chernoff informed his crew as he pushed over into an attack on the American submarine. He armed his number one depth charge pack and roared low over the Tennessee. Chernoff noticed two strange, almost frothy trails leading away from the American sub. His spine grew cold as he traced the two trails of frothy water to the Akromiev.
Bastards! Kromiev yelled.
Captain Siryovchik, the submarine has fired two torpedoes at the Akromiev!
The pilot shouted into his microphone.
What?
The stunned master replied.
Report again!
The American has fired two torpedoes at you, your ship, Captain!
The pilot radioed breathlessly. Chernoff armed all five remaining depth charge and rolled into another attack on the American submarine. He noticed something move in his periphery and glanced to his right. The shocking sight of the onrushing air-to-air missile would be the last picture in Chernoff's young mind. The Kamov exploded into a fireball, raining debris over 1 square mile of ocean. Hutchison pulled hard on the stick, shooting skyward as he rolled the F-14 inverted for a better view of the fallen Kamov.
Home plate, Mad Dog 1, Hutchison radioed the Constellation. We're over the... God damn! The ship just exploded, Hutchison reported.
What ship exploded? CIC responded.
The Russian, the ASW. It blew up in my face.
Mad Dog, you were not authorized to initiate...
The ship exploded again! Unbelievable! Home plate, Mad Dog 1 did not, I repeat, did not fire on the ship. I have a tally on the Tennessee. They're surfacing.
What condition is the Soviet vessel? CIC asked.
It's dead in the water, Mad Dog 1 replied. They're definitely going down.
Mr. President, the situation is extremely serious. We are unanimous in our recommendation, Admiral Chambers said, aware of the increasing tension in the Oval Office. It is imperative that you declare a defense condition pre-alert immediately, sir.
Mr. President, the situation is explosive. We haven't been this close to war in decades. The Chief of Staff, Grant Wilkinson, paused.
I propose that you initiate DEFCON 3 and return the call to Zelenkov without delay.
This is a radical step you're proposing. I'm not certain the incidents that have occurred thus far warrant such measures. Where do we stand, Grant?
Sir, the Soviets are pressing us to the wall. We have satellite confirmation of massive tank movements in Europe. Many sorties have already been flown over Allied territory in our battle groups.
Wilkinson paused while the President opened his briefing folder and skimmed the first and second pages.
This reliable information, Admiral?
Yes, sir, Chambers replied. Our underwater detectives have verified 6 Russian subs off the East Coast, plus 3 more off the coast of Florida. The subs you have already been briefed on.
Sir, if we don't stand up, don't go into an alert status, they are going to continue to push until we make a mistake, Wilkinson interjected.
They're the ones who have broken the rules we've been playing by for the past 30 years.
Wilkinson paused, then continued. Sir, Zelenkov is one tough bastard.
Okay, Admiral, the President said, looking toward Chambers. Go to DEFCON 3 and brief me in 3 hours.
The General Secretary placed the secure phone receiver down, turning slowly to face his 4 Politburo co-conspirators and the Minister of Defense. Zelenkov's grin spread across his face.
The American has no idea, comrades. They have implemented an alert-free status, their first step in preparation for war. We will continue to push them further to Defense Condition 2. If we can successfully continue to probe the American defense posture, we will enjoy the psychological advantage when we withdraw, the General Secretary smiled. Now we will see what the American reaction will be when we sink their ship, Virginia.
The group glanced at each other in concern.
Actually, my friends, Zelenkov said, ignoring the questioning looks, the loss of the Akromiev gives us the opportunity to press the Americans even closer. If we can confirm a 14 to 16 minute delay in the American decision and reaction time to our missiles in their alert 2 status, we have positive proof, comrades, that our first strike initiative will work. Our biological and chemical attacks will follow hours after the nuclear strike. We have targeted all major American military installations, including large overseas bases. Comrades, the Soviet Union will never have a better opportunity than the present. Our empire, along with our satellite countries, will disintegrate unless we strike the United States very soon.
The senior Politburo member, Alexandra Pulyev, interjected a question.
Viktor Pavlovich, how accurate can we expect the American retaliatory strikes to be? Our new commander of the Strategic Rocket Forces is certain the Americans will only achieve 10 to 20% accuracy with their missiles after our massive strike. Because of the satellite destruction? Absolutely, Solinkov answered. We don't have to hit all the navigation satellites to make the targeting systems unreliable. Viktor Pavlovich, does anyone besides the six of us and Marshal Bogdanov know anything about this initiative?
No, of course not, Zelenkov said. The military commanders believe these actions I have ordered are in response to escalating aggression by the Americans.
The room remained silent.
This is not an initiative. This is an all-out, massive nuclear strike on the United States.
Rex Hayes listened intently to the president's chief of staff. He had been surprised when Wilkinson called to brief him personally on the Russian situation. What do you think about moving the launch time up a day or two along with an unpublished schedule? Hayes asked.
We don't believe it makes any difference at this point, Wilkinson replied. They know we're in DEFCON 3.
Well, what's the climate between the president and the general secretary?
The president proposed a meeting face-to-face, one-on-one, at the convenience of the general secretary. Zelenkov agreed and suggested a meeting in 24 hours at Lajas. I assume the president accepted.
Oh, yes. Air Force One is being prepared now, and we expect to leave in an hour and a half. Better let you off the phone. This place is a madhouse, and I've got a plane to catch. Good luck with your launch, Rex. The North Atlantic winter storm was developing, and the USS Virginia was dog-tight for heavy seas. Another 240 nautical miles, 9 hours, and she would rendezvous with the Eisenhower Battle Group.
Captain the bridge, Captain the bridge!
Captain Fred Simpson reached for his phone.
This is the captain, Stan. Sir, sonar has picked up a submarine, Russian signature, 2 points off the starboard bow, range 9,000 yards and closing. Stan, we're at DEFCON 3, so sound general quarters and give me the status of our ASW gear, Simpson ordered as he placed the receiver back in the cradle.
The loud warning signal reverberated throughout the ship.
All hands, man your battle stations. General quarters.
Simpson stepped into the bridge. Captain, the ASROCS and launchers are up and ready. Torpedoes and tubes ready and standing by.
Very well, Stan. What about the LAMPS Hilo?
Being readied in the hangar.
Tell Seahawk 38 to launch and commence search pattern.
Yes, sir, replied the petty officer. The pilot, Lieutenant Hector Chavizzi, had the LAMPS-3 helicopter's main rotors up to speed.
Sonar?
Closing on us, sir, the first-class petty officer reported. They're closing the angle of intercept, sir.
Flash to Sinclair, Eisenhower, and Kennedy, Simpson ordered. Tell Ike we need ASW coverage on the double. Is the Hilo up yet?
Lifting off at this time, Captain, Jenkins replied.
Chavizzi yanked the collector up sharply, popping the helicopter into the turbulent air. The darkness was absolute, the stars and the moon blanketed by cloud cover at 3,000 feet. The Soviet hunter-killer submarine immediately registered on their equipment, and Chavizzi changed course slightly, closing slowly on the Russian.
Nest egg, Seahawk 38 has the submarine, Chavizzi radioed the Virginia.
Signature confirmed a Russian hunter-killer. We're making another sweep.
Roger, Seahawk.
The captain looked at the sonar operator, then spoke to the LAMPS pilot again. Let him know you're overhead. We have a Viking on the way. The flash message from the Virginia had been received only seconds before the carrier battle group made a course change toward the cruiser. The remaining Russian sub trailing the Ike and her escorts made the course change and followed. The orbiting Hawkeye was directing the CAP Tomcats, Buzzard 1 and 2, to rendezvous with Viking 706 near the Virginia's location. A Soviet trawler, sprouting electronic gear and antennas, was shadowing the Eisenhower battle group and eavesdropping on their radio conversations. The Russian submarine skipper, stalking the Virginia, was fully aware of the impending arrival of the American anti-submarine aircraft and escort fighters.
"What's up, Greg?" McKenna asked Linnemeyer.
"Not completely sure, sir. The Virginia sent a message indicating they were at general quarters and requesting ASW coverage. A Russian sub is stalking them. Their LAMPS has confirmed the sub, and they've got a helo up in this weather?"
"Yes, sir."
"Can they recover the LAMPS aboard the Virginia in this kind of weather?"
"Possible, Admiral. 50-50, I'd say."
The task force commander turned to the CIC duty officer, Lieutenant Dystrom, and asked to be patched to the LAMPS helicopter.
"Yes, sir," Dystrom replied. "His call sign is Seahawk 38, Admiral."
"Thanks, Lieutenant," McKenna responded.
"Seahawk 38, this is Tango Fox 1. Do you copy?"
Chavizzi heard the message clearly.
"Tango Fox, Seahawk. Seahawk, this is Admiral McKenna. Understand you have ferreted an unwelcome guest."
"Affirmative, sir. We are over him right now."
"Good job, son. How's the weather?"
"I've seen better, Admiral," Chavizzi replied.
"Okay, listen closely. If you have any doubt about landing on your ship safely, any doubt, I want you to head for the carrier and recover here."
"Yes, sir,"
Chavizzi grinned at his co-pilot.
"As soon as the Viking relieves us, we'll be en route to the carrier."
"Buzzard flight, Stingray."
"Go,"
Jim O'Neill, Lieutenant, U.S. Navy, replied.
"Killer 706 is at your 10 o'clock, 12 miles.
"I have him, Buzzard."
Vince Kang Jemmy, flying Buzzard 2, radioed his leader.
"Buzzard flight, Stingray. We've got four pop-ups at your 8 o'clock, 220 out, smoking like gangbusters. The bogeys are closing at, Jesus, 900 knots.
"Where'd they come from?" O'Neill asked.
"Came out of a commercial airline corridor," radioed the surprised controller. "Boom! Just exploded on my screen. Man, have they got some speed on."
Simpson had turned back on course directly to the Eisenhower, relieved to have the Viking overhead. His relief was short-lived when he became aware of the approaching Russian fighters, now an airborne threat. The Virginia was at battle stations, tension coursing through the ship as she topped each wave and plunged into the next abyss, sending tremors reverberating through the hull.
"Captain Sonar, sir, the sub is surfacing," the operator said, "or coming to periscope depth."
Simpson turned to Jenkins.
"Where's the XO? Tell the Viking to get on top of that sub or we're going to be shark bait."
"Jesus! What the hell?"
Everyone ducked or flinched as a brilliant flash turned night into bright day, and for a millisecond there was a streak of light accompanied by a resounding crack and a low rumble.
"Mayday! Mayday! Killer 706, we've been hit. We're going in. Eject!"
Outside, less than a mile from the Virginia, a flaming ball of debris was tumbling toward the ocean. "Captain Simpson, the sub shot down the Viking.
What do you want to do? Commence firing on the sub," Simpson ordered.
"Sams! Sams!" Canned Jemmy radioed. "The Viking is down!"
Suddenly the darkness glowed miles in front of the American planes. A high-pitched warble sounded in the ears of the four pilots and their RIOs. The Russian fighter pilots had launched their air-to-air missiles in unison.
"Buzzard flight, launch missiles," O'Neill ordered. 3 and 4, break right. 1 and 2, going for knots, coming left."
O'Neill's fighter exploded in horrendous fireball. More explosions lit the night.
"Stingray, we're going down! Mayday! Mayday!" shouted a high-pitched voice. "We're punching!"
3 seconds later, Canned Jemmy felt the impact of a Russian air-to-air missile. He was blinded by the explosion as his Tomcat tumbled toward the icy water. Canned Jemmy yelled to his RIO,
"Eject! Eject!"
1 half-second later, Canned Jemmy hurtled into space to join his radar intercept officer. O'Neill viewed the devastation in shock and pain as he descended below the cloud base. He could see the Virginia in the distance, flames and smoke pouring from the aft section of the cruiser. It appeared to O'Neill as if the entire fantail was ablaze. The sky was still lit by explosions and parachute flares as O'Neill slowly drifted toward the Virginia, suspended by his parachute risers over the flames and falling debris. A sudden flash to his left, followed seconds later by an explosive noise, marked the grave of his Tomcat fighter. Canned Jemmy's parachute opened with shocking force from the high-speed ejection. As the slightly injured Marine aviator descended below the clouds, struggling with his survival gear, another aircraft smashed into the water with a deafening concussion. Hector Chavizzi was only 20 miles from the Virginia when he heard the melee erupt. The lieutenant wheeled his helicopter around in a 180-degree turn and raced for his ship as fast as the LAMPS would go. He briefed his crew and called the Hawkeye. Stingray Seahawk 38 proceeding back to the Virginia, standing by for rescue coordination. Roger, Seahawk, the surprised Hawkeye controller responded. We've got a basket of shit here. Two Tomcats, the Texaco and the Viking down. Search all quadrants around the Virginia. We'll go, Stingray. After the first torpedo explosion rocked the Virginia, Simpson fired two ASROC missiles at the Soviet submarine. The Virginia was racked by another violent explosion, shattering windows and the bridge. The ship was slowly and rapidly starting to list to the starboard.
Captain, the sonar man yelled across the bridge. We got the sub breaking up, sir.
You positive? Simpson shouted.
Yes, sir, no question.
Jenkins spoke from behind. Captain, damage control says they contained the fire. One propulsion system is out of commission and seven compartments are flooded.
What about casualties?
14 confirmed dead, sir, including Commander Rizon.
No estimate or injured yet. Everyone is too busy at the moment.
Very well, Mr. Jenkins, Simpson sighed. Bud was a good man. All of them were good men.
Yes, sir, Jenkins responded.
The best.
The new Boeing executive configured 747 was cruising at 41,000 feet when Grant Wilkinson, carrying a flash message, rushed into the president's private dining room. Mr. President, the Russians attacked one of our ships, the Virginia, son of a bitch.
When?
Approximately 20 minutes ago. The Virginia is badly damaged but afloat.
What are our total losses? The president asked.
Two fighters, a tanker plane, and an anti-sub aircraft are confirmed at this time.
How the hell did we lose that many aircraft?
Sir, the Russians had fighters up, came out of nowhere. They shot down two of our Tomcats and the tanker aircraft before our pilots had it.
Did we get any of their fighters?
Yes, sir. Three.
What do you think, Grant?
Obviously deliberate, Wilkinson sighed. An insane move on the eve of our meeting with Zelenkov. Just beyond comprehension.
I agree wholeheartedly, Grant. The president looked straight into the eyes of his chief of staff.
Order DEFCON 2 and notify Lejas that I demand to see Zelenkov immediately upon arrival.
Yes, sir, Wilkinson replied.
He leaned forward.
Mr. President, I wish to offer an opinion and suggestion.
I'm open to anything, Grant, the president responded.
Sir, DEFCON 2 is tantamount to a declaration of war, or as close as one can get to war before pushing the final button.
Agree. Go on.
I recommend that we contact our operative in the Kremlin, in the quarters of the General Secretary, and see if he can obtain any relevant intelligence for us. He will most likely be sacrificed. We've had him in place for 2.5 years, but we need substantial information now, Mr. President.
I could not agree more.
The president paused.
How reliable is this agent, Grant?
Very reliable, by all indications, sir. He is highly regarded at Langley.
Very well. Make contact as quickly as possible and give me an update on the DEFCON 2 status when you have an opportunity.
Will do, sir.
Dmitry Karpov, the former Leonid Vochik, was nervously pacing back and forth in his small, barren room as he ground out one cigarette and lighted another. He had to make contact with his American connection as quickly as possible. He reached behind his footlocker and retrieved the clear canning jar of Stolichnaya vodka, one of the perks Dmitry enjoyed as head of the General Secretary's kitchen staff. The large glass container had been full 2 hours ago when Dmitry was released from kitchen duty. It now contained less than two-thirds of the clear liquid as Dmitry raised it to his lips for another long pull. He sat down in his only chair, wishing he could be with Svetlana in her warm bed. He took another swig of the vodka, lighted a fresh cigarette, and planned a way to contact his Central Intelligence Agency control. There wasn't time to wait for the scheduled ritual. There was too much pressure, and he longed to purge himself of the devastating knowledge gained in the hallway outside the General Secretary's quarters. Kremlin domestic help was not allowed to leave the compound when the evening shift ended at 11 o'clock. Working-class staff could leave the immediate area only when their rotation placed them on duty from 5 o'clock in the morning to 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Dmitri, who had received special permission to leave the Kremlin grounds at 7 o'clock in the morning, would have only 6 or 7 hours to contact his CIA connection. His assigned agent was aware that Dmitri would not be eligible to leave the Kremlin compound until his work schedule rotated the following week. Would the American even be in the vicinity? His unusual behavior, Dmitri realized, would place him in a precarious situation, especially if the KGB noticed his change of pattern. He silently cursed the bad fortune of being on the evening work shift. Swallowing another 2 ounces of the crystal-clear liquid, Dmitri reconciled himself to the fact that he simply didn't have a choice. He had an obligation to his country, America. The huge presidential jet made a straight-in approach to Lajas do Pico Azores. During a landing rollout, Grant Wilkinson, with a quick knock, entered the president's private study. "What is it, Grant?" "Sir, NORAD is now tracking 3 large Soviet bomber groups, each escorted by 50 or 60 fighters." Wilkinson paused, seeing the president yank at his tie. "Where are they located?" "One group, approximately 70 to 80 bombers, is 50 miles north of NORCAP, Finland. The other groups are split and appear to be converging north of Komdorsky Island, approximately 500 miles northwest of Adak, Alaska." "What's been our response?" "The Bering Sea join-up is considered the most serious problem at the present time. They aren't far from our bases in the Aleutian Islands in Alaska. The bombers are staging from their Arctic air base." "NORAD reports the Alaskan Air Command on full alert, sir. We have Air Force and Navy fighter groups joining the Russian formations." The president visibly stiffened. "How long until our boys intercept the bombers?"
"About 1 hour, sir."
"Let's meet our greeting party. I want to have all the handshaking and ceremonial posturing over with when Zelenkov steps on the ground. I intend to blow the air out of his arrival and nail him to the post on the spot." Ted Corbin, director of the Central Intelligence Agency, sat next to Marine General Hollingsworth as the Secretary of Defense outlined the DEFCON 2 status report in the White House Situation Room. The Vice President of the United States and former Navy lawyer Susan Blaylock chaired the tense early morning meeting.
"Ted, where are we in regard to contacting the Kremlin agent?" Blaylock asked.
"We have 2 of our best men attempting to make contact at this time, around the clock."
"Why is it so difficult?"
"The surveillance in and around the Kremlin is very thorough. But the operative we are trying to contact has a girlfriend who has a small apartment by the Tanganyika Theater. When Dmitri journeys to the woman's apartment, our men observe him from different locations. If our operative, Dmitri, has anything of significance to report, he folds his arms across his chest with the left wrist on top of his right wrist. If he has nothing to report, the opposite arm fold is used. If our plant and one of the agents need to communicate, the agent waits at the central Moscow train station for the operative. If Dmitri takes his train ticket money out of his right pocket, he is going to Gorky. If it's in the left pocket, the destination is Kharkov."
"So the contact is made on board the train?"
"Yes. When the agent visits the toilet facilities, Dmitri joins him for a brief update."
"So, Ted, we can anticipate information from the Kremlin operative within 24 hours?
"That is correct."
The 5 astronauts assigned to the SDI satellite placement mission had been awakened early. Breakfast would be later, they were told. Planned to attend a briefing in 30 minutes. End of statement. Doors shut. Then Rex Hayes and mission controller Ken Miller entered the room.
"Well, fellas, hell of a time to get you out of bed, but you've had a change of plans."
The astronauts had cautious looks on their faces.
"You men are aware of the global tension at the present time and the increased security here at the Cape," Hayes said. "We have been informed by the Secretary of Defense to launch the SDI missile at the earliest possible time. Unannounced, no media, middle of the night. The President has decided to go for early launch, in view of what happened in the Atlantic. He believes the Russians won't attempt anything with the General Secretary under scrutiny in Lajas. We plan to launch this evening, gentlemen."
Surprise registered on the 5 faces in the audience. Colonel Crawford, caught off guard, spoke first.
"Can we do that? We haven't completed the pre-flight checklist yet. The final fueling is underway. We are keeping everything low-key, business as usual."
Dmitri was startled when the alarm sounded at 6 o'clock. Shaving and bathing quickly, he dressed in fresh warm clothes, checked his credentials, buttoned his heavy coat, and walked to the security entrance for lower-ranking domestic workers.
"Up early, Dmitri," the guard said in a friendly greeting. "Yes, comrade," Dmitri responded.
Dmitri tried to be calm and appear normal, but his heart was pounding. He walked across Red Square, passing the 8 domes of St. Basile's, and turned down the side street leading to Svetlana's tiny apartment. Dmitri rounded a corner and almost walked into his most frequent CIA connection.
"Excuse me, I'm sorry," Dmitri blurted, shocked by the unexpected encounter. "No harm, comrade," the American agent responded in flawless Russian.
Steve Wickham, the senior CIA agent in Moscow, stepped off the sidewalk and around Dmitri. The American agent stopped, apparently gazing at fresh bread being placed in a shop window. Actually, he was staring at Dmitri in the reflection of the glass. The Kremlin mole was slowly strolling by the shop windows, his arms folded left over right.
"Damn, I gotta go for it," Wickham said to himself.
There wasn't time to go through all the steps and take all the usual precautions. Dmitri, adrenaline surging through his body, slowly continued toward the apartment. He glanced in a window and saw the CIA agent retracing his steps. As he passed the Kremlin mole, the American spoke to him in Russian, his hand covering his mouth as he appeared to inhale from a cigarette. "Meet me at Chlebnikov restaurant." "Let's be first in line, gentlemen," the president stated as the three Americans walked to the front of the red carpet being placed beside the Soviet jet. As General Secretary Zelenkov reached the bottom of the stairs, the American president raised his hand for a perfunctory handshake. The Soviet leader weakly returned the gesture.
"Secretary Zelenkov," the president confronted the Soviet general secretary, "we need to talk immediately."
The general secretary spoke in Russian and smiled thinly. "Mr. President," the Soviet interpreter repeated, "we are scheduled for discussions this afternoon. We have scarcely arrived, and our hosts have planned a welcome."
"Secretary Zelenkov, recent events dictate that we dispense with protocol and address the urgent issues at hand," the president said. "Many of our military people are dead as a result of Soviet aggression. In recent hours, a Russian submarine heavily damaged one of our ships, and Soviet fighters shot down several of our aircraft without provocation."
Zelenkov spoke forcefully, then waited while the interpreter responded.
"The General Secretary warns you are not on Soviet soil, Mr. Zelenkov," the President said, ignoring the interpreter. "It would serve you well to remember that one fact. You don't warn or threaten anyone here."
The Russian leader was flustered, off guard, and visibly agitated. He spoke loudly, then listened as the interpreter addressed the American.
"Where do you propose we talk?"
"We have arranged a space in the large hangar across the ramp. Let's walk together," the president suggested.
The two leaders walked a short distance to the hangar. The president turned to the Soviet delegation and motioned them to join him at the center table. Two large sheets had hurriedly been placed over the stained surface of the scarred banquet table. The president, along with Wilkinson and Kohlhammer, sat down. The Soviet contingent hesitated a moment, then slowly sat down with the Americans. Zelenkov began.
"We, the Russian people, Mr. President, don't want a war with the United States, or anyone for that matter. We are a peaceful country, offering..."
"General Secretary Zelenkov," the President interrupted, "our dispute is not with the people of Russia, but with its totalitarian, expansionist policies which violate international law."
"Mr. President, I must remind you that your country has been responsible for sinking 2 Soviet Union vessels, a submarine and a ship of the Soviet Pacific Fleet."
The president responded immediately, his neck becoming rigid. "You are fully aware, as everyone at this table is aware, that Soviet aggression caused us to respond in kind. Secretary Zelenkov, your actions have brought us to the brink of war. That is why we are meeting here. Mr. Zelenkov, let me assure you of one thing. Don't underestimate the American resolve, our dedication to freedom. We are a civilized nation, but we mean what we say."
Dmitri sat down at a vacant table in the Chilitnikov restaurant, lighted a cigarette, and ordered hot tea. The CIA agent walked boldly through the door and announced in Russian that he was a KGB officer and wanted to see Dmitri's papers. Everyone was shocked into silence. Two patrons left a couple of rubles on their table and went out the front door with their coats not fully buttoned. The American ordered Dmitri to the kitchen, where the agent told the small Russian woman and her young helper to leave them alone for 5 minutes. The two women were more than relieved to disappear from the compact room and the dreaded KGB officer. "Your report, quickly," Wickham said, speaking in English. "Zelenkov plans... they plan to launch nuclear missiles on the United States." "What?" The CIA operative grabbed Dmitri by the shoulders. "I heard the General Secretary talk at length last night with three Politburo members and a former member of the Politburo." "Well, when is he planning to initiate the preemptive strike?" "I'm not sure the exact time," Dmitri responded. He said very soon. "They have planned for the Americans to be off guard. He, Secretary Zelenkov, used the term first strike. He said when the military withdraws, when the alert is over, then the strike will happen." "Do you recall any other pertinent information?" "They talked about how long it would take the Americans to react to a missile launch from the Soviet Union. The General Secretary said if the Russians have a 16-minute period of time before the United States reacts, then they can successfully destroy America. They intend to sink an American ship, escalate, I believe they said, defense conditions to stage two, then withdraw. When the Americans withdraw, Zelenkov is going to launch all the Soviet missiles." "All right, Dmitri. Can you continue in your capacity, or do you want out?" Wickham could see that Dmitri, the agent's only Kremlin in-house operative, was on the threshold of breaking. "I want out," Dmitri said. "I can't stay here, knowing what they are going to..." "Tell them your mother is worse. Explain that you have to leave now to see her one last time." "Yes, sir." "You must be bold, Dmitri. You must give us a little time to organize your trip out, okay?"
"Yes, sir, I can do it."
"Take the train to Yemensk, and then wait to hear from us. We'll be in touch soon."
"I will leave this afternoon, but..."
Dmitri paused.
"What about my girl? We plan to marry when my commitment is..."
"Impossible. Look, we will be lucky to get out alive under the circumstances." The American gently squeezed Dmitri's shoulders. "I'm sorry, it's just too risky. You must understand." Dmitri nodded, frightened and dejected.
"I understand."
"We've got to get out of here. You walk in front of me to the front door." Changing back to fluent Russian, the covert operative gave Dmitri an order. "You report back to work immediately. You will be contacted soon. Your papers are not in compliance."
"Yes, comrade," Dmitri replied.
Dmitri walked into the street, trying to sort out what he would tell Svetlana. He had to find a way to get her out of Russia. Dmitri saw the CIA agent disappear down a side street next to the restaurant. The Kremlin operative also saw something else. A black Volga bearing KGB tags turned down the same side street behind the American. Dmitri froze. He looked around, sensing other KGB agents near. He had to do something. Now. Think, he told himself. The words, "be bold," came back to him. Dmitri hurried himself back across the street and followed the black car down the side street. Ahead, he could see Wickham stepping slowly off the sidewalk to cross the narrow street. Dmitri slowed his walk. The Volga stopped 20 meters from the CIA agent. The two occupants got out of the car and approached the lone man. The American continued his normal pace, stepping onto the opposite sidewalk as the two Russian agents confronted him. The three men then stepped into a concealed space between two rusted, peeling buildings. Dmitri moved forward cautiously. He could see the three men clearly now. The American presented his credentials to the KGB officers and stepped back. The Soviet agents looked at the papers, then told Wickham to turn around and place his hands over his head, forehead against the rough wall. The taller of the two Russians then pulled a snub-nosed gun from his coat as his companion placed the American's credentials in his vest pocket. Dmitri reacted without thinking. Running at full speed into the narrow space, Dmitri barreled into the two KGB agents. The impact knocked all four men down in a thundering crash. The American leaped to his feet, whirled around, and solidly kicked the taller Russian under the chin, breaking his neck and crushing his larynx. Dmitri, struggling to regain his footing, saw only a blur as Wickham slung a rubbish can lid into the skull of the other KGB agent, rendering him unconscious. The American yanked Dmitri to his feet, grabbed the snub-nosed revolver, retrieved his credentials, and ushered the frightened young spy into the street. "Follow me. We've got to leave Moscow immediately." "Yes, sir," Dmitri responded.
Stay 20 meters behind me and keep your eyes open. Yes, sir. The two men walked at a steady pace, slightly separated, as a shocked crowd gathered around the inert Soviet agents. Dmitri and the tall CIA agent rounded the first street corner and ducked into a narrow hallway. Dmitri, his pulse racing, broke into a half-run as the CIA operative quickened the pace. Hang on, Dmitri. Two more minutes and we'll be in my apartment.
Okay, I'm not...
Don't talk, barked the agent. Just listen. When we get to the apartment, we will change into disguises to facilitate our escape. We will become Soviet bureaucrats, agriculture inspectors traveling to Leningrad to examine the truck farming administrative center. The credentials are flawless. I will brief you on the train, Wickham continued as they started up the steps to the apartment building.
Okay.
The KGB will be circulating our descriptions throughout the city in a matter of minutes. You'll be missed at the Kremlin by mid-afternoon.
Yes, before, probably.
We will have some time, not a lot, but enough to prepare adequately for our trip. Dmitri nodded. The agent reached for his keys, unlocked the door, and the two men stepped inside. The American immediately went to the window and peered into the street. The KGB is already out in force, the CIA operative reported. Dmitri, I hope you can appreciate how serious this is. The agent released the window curtain and turned to face Dmitri. His eyes widened, and he pointed his finger at Dmitri's right hand.
Dmitri, your hand is bleeding.
Both men stared at the bright red blood steadily dripping on the floor. The two agents realized they had left a clearly marked trail to the apartment. Their sanctuary was now a death trap. The CIA agent shoved Dmitri toward the tiny bathroom. Wash your hands off and wrap it with gauze, Wickham said, yanking open drawers. Keep your gloves on. The American agent quickly combed white powder through his hair, creating an instant aging effect. Wickham, donning different trousers, white shirt, conservative black tie, and long black top coat, began to look like a Soviet bureaucrat. He topped off the ensemble with a black, Russian-made, medium-brimmed hat. The agent tossed Dmitri a pair of pants, long coat, and a similar black hat.
Get into those quick. Remember how to use this?
Wickham asked, tossing Dmitri a 9mm Beretta.
Yes, Dmitri responded.
Don't, unless you absolutely have to, the agent said. He thrust a package of credentials into Dmitri's inside coat pocket and peered out the window. They quickly stepped back.
Oh, shit, they're on us, Dmitri. Let's go.
The two men raced down the hallway, clambered through a window, went partway down a fire escape, and leaped over a fence into an adjoining courtyard. Together, the men raced toward the Moscow suburb of Barviha, where the CIA operatives had a Volga.
Hurry, Dmitri. We can't outrun their dogs. Wickham's breathing had become labored.
Dmitri's response was a gasp, a croak.
Okay.
The two men emerged from a narrow passage between two buildings, 150 meters from the waiting Volga, and started walking across the street. Suddenly, the American pushed Dmitri into a row of shrub trees. Wickham pointed down the street. Dmitri could see the black KGB car 200 meters past the Volga, their escape vehicle. Two GRU officers, one holding the leash of a Doberman Pinscher, were talking with the driver. The American quietly motioned to Dmitri. Follow me and stay alert. They forced their way through the shrubs and hedges until they were in a small yard. We'll cut between the buildings, then try to approach from the Dacha directly in front of the car. The two men crept across three small private yards and stealthily approached the side of the Dacha in front of the parked Volga. Wickham motioned Dmitri to kneel down.
Listen, Wickham whispered. The keys are in a special container under the left rear fender. I'm going to head for the car, get the keys, and unlock the driver's door. Then, and only then, you walk casually out and get in the other side. Understand, Dmitri?
Clearly?
Yes,
Dmitri said. Wickham nervously looked around the corner of the porch. The GRU officers and their Doberman were slowly crossing the street, approaching the row of Dachas in front of the Volga. The KGB men were still in their car with the passenger door open.
Dmitri, it's very simple. We have no other choice. If we stay here, I guarantee you we will be dead or imprisoned or tortured very shortly.
Yes, sir. Put your weapon in your outside coat pocket. If we need them, we'll damn sure use them. Dmitri nodded.
Here we go,
Wickham said as he walked from the side of the porch. The American stepped between a tall hedge and the outside door of the Dacha, pretending to be leaving the residence. He opened, then slammed the outside door, casually strolling down the short steps.
Good morning, comrades, the American agent said in perfect Russian.
Dmitri was petrified as he watched the agent talk to the KGB officers.
Morning, came the brisk reply.
Wickham reached for the keys as the GRU officers started back across the street. The American unlocked the driver's door. Dmitri stood upright and started toward the car.
Without warning, the door to the Dacha opened, startling Dmitri. A pretty Russian woman appeared.
"What do you want?"
she cried, alarmed at the presence of GRU officers across the street. The two officers stopped, turned around, a quizzical look on their faces. The American turned and spoke to her in Russian. "We apologize," Wickham said loudly. "We knocked at the wrong Dacha. We have the wrong address." Dmitri hesitated, then started for the car. "Halt!" the GRU senior officer commanded. "Stop where you are!"
"Run, Dmitri," the American ordered. "Get in the car!"
As Dmitri rounded the corner of the car, a black object hit him from the side. He felt searing pain in his right ear, then heard a loud shot close to him. Wickham had shot the Doberman when he glanced off Dmitri.
"Get in!"
the American shouted as he leaped into the driver's seat and inserted the key. Dmitri plunged headlong into the car as Wickham floorboarded the Volga and careened into traffic. The black KGB car made a U-turn and was recklessly pursuing the two CIA men, swerving wildly to miss oncoming vehicles. Wickham yelled at Dmitri to keep his head down, then glanced in the rearview mirror at the pursuing automobile. At that precise instant, the rear window was shattered by three rounds from a KGB submachine gun. The vice president, surrounded by Cliff Howard, Secretary of Defense, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, waited for Ted Corbin to enter the Situation Room. The director of the Central Intelligence Agency had called the vice president only minutes before to report an irregularity in Moscow. Corbin entered the room, tie askew, and sat down. "Something has gone wrong in Moscow. We only know, at this juncture, that our senior field operative and the Kremlin plant have been involved in an altercation with the KGB. Our mole was apparently onto something. He violated the normal procedure for contacting the senior agent, and, we believe, that initiated the screw-up." Corbin glanced at his notes as he fumbled with his attaché case, then continued. "Apparently, from preliminary reports, Wickham and Dmitri escaped on foot from the incident with the KGB. We don't know where they are at this time." Cliff Howard broke the silence. "I don't intend to be the harbinger of doom, but this is the last thing we need with the president in Lajas."
"Ted," the vice president spoke, "do we have a contingency plan to get our agents out of Russia without creating an international embarrassment?"
"Yes," Corbin responded. "Miss Blaylock, if the operatives are alive, if they have their satellite transmitter, then we intend to rescue them with high-speed helicopters."
"Okay, Ted. Explain the operation to us," Blaylock ordered.
"We have three Nighthawk helicopters camouflaged in Russian livery in the hold of a cargo ship in the Baltic Sea near Stockholm. When we know the location of our agents, the helos will take off at night. We have a prearranged site outside of Novgorod to land the rescue helicopter. It will be on the ground only a few seconds, just long enough for our agents to leap aboard." "Then what?" Howard asked. "The two helicopters will fly diversionary routes, while the helo containing our agents will fly to Stockholm, where we will place them aboard an Air Force transport plane bound for Washington."
"What is the bottom line chance for a successful helicopter rescue, as you've outlined?" Blaylock asked.
"The chances are 50-50, Corbin shot back.
"Thank you," Blaylock responded. "I will take your information under advisement."
She turned to the Secretary of Defense.
"Cliff, what's the status of the shuttle?"
"Final stages, ma'am. The countdown has started. No reports of security problems. Actually, no significant problems at all, so far." The 4.4 million pound space shuttle, poised for flight, was bathed in soft moonlight. The tempo was picking up as the flight crew settled into their launch positions. The liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen had already been pumped into the orbiter. Mission Control now acknowledged the final countdown.
"Houston, Columbia. Event timer started."
"Roger."
"Columbia, initiate APU pre-start."
"Roger, Houston," Crawford replied.
"Powering up APUs."
"Columbia, you are on internal power."
"Copy, internal,"
Crawford said back. At T-minus 3 minutes, the orbiter's main engines swiveled to their launch positions.
"Columbia, main engine gimbal complete."
"Copy, Houston." You are a go for launch at this time.
Go for launch, Crawford responded.
At T-minus 25 seconds, the shuttle countdown switched over to onboard computers.
15 seconds and counting, Houston reported.
5, 4,
we have main engine start. 2, 1, 0,
SRB ignition, liftoff.
We have liftoff.
At T-plus 2.64 seconds, the shuttle's rocket boosters ignited.
The tower has been cleared. All engines look good, Houston informed the orbiter crew.
Roger, Houston. Looking good here.
Stand by for separation.
The solid rocket boosters exploded off the shuttle, falling smoothly in a graceful arc.
Houston, we have separation, Crawford reported.
We can see that. Looks good, Columbia.
Another minute passed.
Columbia, go for the main engine cutoff.
Roger, main engine cutoff on schedule, Crawford replied.
Columbia, go for the external tank separation.
The huge orange tank fell away, tumbling to its destruction in the ocean far below.
We have separation.
Looks clean, Crawford radioed.
We have achieved orbit, Houston.
Congratulations, Columbia. Time to go to work.
Dimitri stared, frozen in horror, at the Volga's blood-splattered windshield.
Wipe off my window, the American agent was shouting above the roar of the engine. His right arm was hanging limp, blood coursing down his sleeve.
Dimitri used his forearm to clear a section of the windshield, losing his balance as the car skidded through a corner and bounced off a curb.
Return their fire! Now, goddammit, shoot at the grill!
Dimitri fumbled for his Beretta. Shaking violently, he placed it over the front seat, staring at the black KGB car 70 meters in trail.
Grab it with both hands, like you were taught. Rest the weapon on top of the seat and aim for the grill.
Boom! 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 The windshield of the KGB car shattered in an explosion of glass particles and metal fragments. The pursuing automobile swerved to the right and crashed into the back of a parked truck.
Outstanding! Wickham yelled.
Dimitri, take off your belt. Make a tourniquet under my armpit and over my shoulder, the agent groaned, as close to my neck as possible.
As Dimitri applied the tourniquet, the CIA agent briefed him. We're going to steal a bureaucrat's car and drive to an outlying train station.
We have our credentials, the agent groaned again. And I can camouflage my shoulder and head. Reach in the glove box and reload your weapon. Put some extra rounds in your coat pocket.
Dimitri complied as they turned a corner next to a government building by the Hotel Minsk.
Wickham drove past the parking lot area and turned into a narrow alley. He stopped the car and turned to the young spy.
Dimitri, walk across the street and wait for me by the row of trees next to the corner. I'll pick you up in 5 minutes. Don't do anything to draw attention.
Wickham looked down at his shoulder. Understand?
Yes, Dimitri said.
By the row of trees.
The two men got out of the car. Dimitri walked across the busy street while the American proceeded toward the parking area.
Secretary Zelenkov, before we can proceed with any meaningful dialogue, I have to insist on a condition.
The president looked straight into Zelenkov's eyes.
What is this, you say, condition?
Turn back your bomber groups. The groups approaching our east and west coasts. We cannot talk under a cloud of threats and provocations.
The president stared at Zelenkov. The Russian clamped his jaws together. The room grew quiet, everyone waiting for the Soviet leader's reply.
Zelenkov, without speaking to the president, turned to his foreign minister.
Send the message. The groups are to turn back immediately.
Yes, Comrade Secretary.
The president, inwardly pleased and relieved, waited for Zelenkov to speak.
It is done, Mr. President, in good faith. I am a reasonable man, as you can see.
Your quick response is sincerely appreciated, General Secretary Zelenkov. A step in the direction of peace. The president turned to Kohlhammer, his secretary of state.
Herb, downgrade to defense condition 3 immediately, on my authority.
Yes, Mr. President.
Zelenkov smiled at the president. It made no difference to him if the Americans went to their condition 3 status. He already had the information he needed. The Americans were honest and gullible. They would react to the threats. The plan would work. Russia
would soon rule the world. Dmitri stood by the row of trees, nervously glancing up and down the street. He shifted his weight from one foot to the other, then back again while he watched the parking area where the American had disappeared. A dark Lada bearing government markings pulled alongside the curb. "Let's go," the American shouted in Russian, barely stopping the car. Dmitri bolted into the automobile. Wickham roared into traffic. "Where are we going?" Dmitri asked. "To Kachlin, to catch the train. 2-hour drive at most. When we get there, we'll submerge the car in the river. Then we'll separate to enter the train station a few minutes apart. Now you go into the men's room and enter a stall. Stay in there until the train arrives. I'll come and get you when it's time to board."
"I understand. Where are we going?"
"The train will take us close to Leningrad. We'll get off outside Novgorod, next to the Volkhov River. When we get off the train, I'll send a prearranged signal via satellite. That will set the rescue operation in motion. I have a satellite transmitter sewn inside my topcoat. When we are in place, at the pickup point, I'll send a coded message, and the helos will be en route almost immediately. I have a UHF radio built into the satellite transmitter. I'll be able to talk with the pilots when they are within 15 or 20 miles of our operation." The Lada rounded a corner, and the American continued his explanation to the frightened young operative. "Dmitri, when we get close to
Oh, shit!"
Both men saw the checkpoint simultaneously. The guardhouse and the closed gate were only 400 meters away as the American started slowing the Lada. "Dmitri, quick, grab the scarf from my right coat pocket and wrap it around my neck. Make sure it covers the blood around my collar."
"It's covered,"
Dmitri responded. "Drape the end over my torn shoulder." Wickham squirmed as a sharp pain shot through his shoulder.
"Got it?"
"It's completely covered," Dmitri said as he spread the scarf over the agent's wound. "Okay, Dmitri, I'll talk. We're agriculture inspectors, so act like one." Wickham motioned to Dmitri. "Get out your credentials." The Lada slowed. Two guards, one with a Kalashnikov rifle and the other brandishing a submachine gun, stood in front of the closed gate. The American brought the automobile to a smooth stop as the guards approached the Lada, one on each side.
"Greetings, comrades," the American said, displaying his credentials. "Step out and open the trunk," the Soviet guard ordered.
"Yes, comrade." Wickham's mind raced. Knowing he didn't have a key to the trunk, he had hot-wired the ignition to start the car. The American rounded the end of the automobile, appearing to search for a key.
"What is wrong with your arm, comrade inspector?" the Russian asked, suspicion written all over his face.
"Farming accident, comrade, many years ago in Grozny."
"Comrade inspector, this is not an agricultural bureau automobile. It is registered to the state medical department."
"That is true, comrade. Our vehicle was in for routine service and inspection. The bureau directorate procured this automobile for our trip."
The other guard, listening to the conversation, was examining Dmitri's credentials through the open passenger window.
"Open the trunk, comrade inspector," the guard again ordered.
"I'm afraid they didn't give me a key to the trunk, the inept blunderheads," responded the American as he noticed the other guard carrying Dmitri's credentials into the guardhouse. If he got on the phone with the false papers, it was all over.
"Comrade inspector, let me have your key to the ignition," the guard ordered, raising the barrel of the rifle strapped over his shoulder.
"Yes, of course," Wickham replied as he approached the open driver's door. He reached inside as if to retrieve the key and noticed the other guard dialing the wall-mounted phone.
A disturbance at the entrance to the hangar startled the delegation. The Soviet foreign minister barged through the door and strode angrily toward Zelenkov, gesturing for the general secretary to join him in conference. The president, apprehension gnawing at his stomach, watched the agitated foreign minister confer with Zelenkov. The general secretary's face blotched, then turned a deep red, almost purple color. The Kremlin boss, obviously upset, was marching back to a seat opposite the American. He reached his chair and launched into a loud harangue.
"You lied about your space war defense,"
Zelenkov spat. Every person in the hangar was frozen in silence, shock registering on their faces.
"We haven't lied about anything, Mr. Secretary," the president replied.
You have launched your shuttlecraft without warning. Ahead of schedule. Even your own newspaper people did not know of the secret launch.
The president bolted from his chair. It is our prerogative to launch our shuttle when we deem it appropriate. We don't need the permission of the Soviet government or, for that matter, the American news media. Zelenkov was beginning to perspire in the stagnant air.
I thought when I talked with you from Moscow that we had an agreement to discuss your space defense satellites on a foundation of mutual trust.
Oh, we did, sir, and I'm happy to discuss them in a... The president was abruptly cut off when the burly Russian leader slammed his fist on the table, spilling three glasses of water.
Before you launched them, Zelenkov bellowed, you changed the date. We cannot trust the Americans again. Ever. Also,
Zelenkov continued, a smile spreading across his craggy face,
two of your spies have been exposed in Moscow. One of the spies was in charge of my kitchen help. The bastard traitor could have poisoned me, Zelenkov hissed. What is your response?
Mr. Zelenkov, we have nothing else to say, given the circumstances and your state of mind. I will, however, give you a piece of personal advice. Zelenkov exploded.
I don't need any advice from American liars.
The Soviet General Secretary stalked out of the hangar with the Russian contingent close behind. The Russian faces, to a man, reflected anguish and surprise.
What a disaster, the president paused.
Grant, re-establish DEFCON 2, then find out what the hell happened in Moscow. The American CIA agent knew he didn't have a second to waste. One of the Soviet guards, standing in the open door of the guard shack, not 7 meters away, was clearly ringing a number on the wall phone. The guard who had asked for the ignition key was behind him, near the back of the automobile. Wickham didn't hesitate as he straightened his body and half-turned toward the Russian guard.
Oh, come off me, comrade. The keys are here in my coat pocket,
Wickham said as he squeezed the trigger of the Beretta twice. Two small holes appeared near the bottom of the CIA agent's left coat pocket, accompanied by two explosive reports. The shocked Soviet guard, eyes bulging, staggered sideways, then fell head first into the side of the vehicle. The American pumped two rounds into the other guard. Dmitri stared, transfixed, as the American ran to the guard shack, retrieved the critical credentials, then opened the road gate. The Russian soldier in the guard shack, mortally wounded, crawled to the edge of the open door as the Lada sped away. He grasped his ballpoint pen and scratched the tag number and description of the bureau car on the wooden floor. He then collapsed in a pool of his own blood.
Dmitri, listen, Wickham said. Is your weapon fully loaded?
Yes, Dmitri replied. Then change with me and reload mine. Do you have any more ammo in your pocket?
Yes, Dmitri replied in a hushed voice.
Then get on with it. Wickham slowed the Lada to a reasonable speed, then continued.
Dmitri, hang in there. We're in pretty good shape overall.
Dmitri nodded, quietly loading the Beretta as he stared with blank eyes. It will be a while before the guards are found, Dmitri, and there isn't any traceable evidence to link us. The KGB won't know what kind of car to look for. The American looked over at Dmitri.
Come on. Cheer up. We'll be out of Russia tomorrow morning. We're almost home, Dmitri.
The agent returned a faint smile. 20 kilometers behind the Lada, a KGB officer raced into the guard shack and turned the Russian soldier over. The KGB agent checked for a pulse. He could see it was useless. The officer walked to the door and waved his companion, who was checking the other slain guard, into the guard shack. Then he reached for the phone, noticing the dead guard had a ballpoint pen clutched in his hand. He leaned down and saw scratch marks, lightly colored in black, across the wooden floor.
The two agents were approaching Staraya, near the pickup point at Novgorod. Wickham had decided against taking the train, too many risks and too much exposure. The Lada had just rounded a curve when the two men heard the sounds. The CIA agent pulled the vehicle to the side of the road and stopped under a grove of barren trees.
What is it? Dmitri whispered.
Wickham opened the door of the Lada and stepped out into the cold air.
He listened intently, then walked closer to the roadside, hesitated a moment, then jumped back in terror. Low, on each side of the road, less than 3 kilometers away, were two Soviet MIL, Mi-28 Advanced Combat Helicopters. It was obvious they were conducting a methodical search-and-destroy mission. The Russian helicopters remained low and moved slowly, checking every square decameter of ground. The stunned American yelled at Dmitri, "Get some tree branches for camouflage! Move! Move!" The two Mi-28s, NATO codename Havoc, were only 2 kilometers away when Wickham ran the Lada under the base of the trees. Wickham and Dmitri yanked down tree branches and limbs to cover the car. The trees were particularly void of foliage in the cold February winter. Both men, in desperation, threw dirt and branches on the Lada. "Come on, Dmitri," the American yelled, holding his right shoulder with his left hand. The two hunched figures raced down the adjacent embankment and splashed through a narrow stream. Wickham struggled up the other side of the narrow stream and motioned for Dmitri to follow. He turned and sprinted towards some large mounds of earth piled next to a field. A rubbish dump was only 2 meters from the knolls. Dmitri rushed after the American. "We'll have to dig in for now and hope the helos keep moving," Wickham stated as both men dove behind the earthen mounds and crawled into the edge of the rubbish. "Don't look up, Dmitri. Don't do anything." The American agent watched the nearest Mi-28 pass directly over the camouflaged Lada, then continue on. The second gunship was across the road and approaching the wrecked Lada. Wickham stopped breathing as the helicopter passed the vehicle, climbed slightly, and continued down the road. Wickham slowly let his breath out and turned toward Dmitri. "Think you can travel in a few minutes, on foot?" "Yes," Dmitri said.
"Dmitri, I'm going to go ahead and send the satellite message." Wickham pointed the antenna straight up and punched in the various codes. He waited 10 seconds and repeated the steps. "We'll have to change our pickup point a ways, but..." The American saw Dmitri's face turn ashen, then reflect stark terror. "What's wrong?" Wickham said as he turned his head. The attack helicopter on the far side of the road had indeed spotted the Lada. They were coming to hover 10 meters over the pavement. The unscheduled vehicular activity had set the satellite deployment mission hours behind time. Crawford was becoming anxious. NASA was growing more nervous by the minute. "Houston, Columbia," Crawford radioed. "Dr. Tran is ready to enter the airlock."
"Roger, copy entering the airlock. We have video."
Dr. Tran checked the airlock's life support system, gave a thumbs-up signal to his fellow crew members, and closed the entry hatch behind him.
"Houston, Min is donning his maneuvering unit and pressurizing the airlock," Crawford reported, waiting for the astronaut to check in via radio.
"Roger, Columbia, looks good."
Tran waited for the pressure to reach 0.2 PSI, then checked in by radio.
"Ready for EVA. Good pressure in here."
"Good, Min. Cleared."
Crawford looked out the viewing port. "And good luck."
Tran opened the outer hatch and floated effortlessly into the cargo bay.
"Houston, I see our problem," the astronaut reported. "Looks as if the tracking and data relay antenna is twisted.
Houston, the antenna is broken. It's actually twisted in half."
"Columbia, Houston, can you effect a repair that will allow the satellite to function?"
"Houston, I'm skeptical," Tran replied, "but I'll give it a try."
Crawford and his crew watched Dr. Tran as he worked on the antenna. 6 minutes. 7 minutes. NASA staff members grew impatient.
"Columbia, Houston," Rex Hayes radioed, talking on his own headset. "Any luck?"
"Not yet," Tran answered.
"I'm going to have to splice the antenna. It may take a few minutes. It's bent 90 degrees.
"Roger," Hayes replied. Crawford spoke to the payload specialist.
"Min, if it looks unsalvageable to you, let's forget the job."
"Skipper, I don't believe this is going to work, but I'd like to lash the antenna together. Take a shot."
"Okay, Min, use your judgment. No pressure,"
Crawford replied as he watched the physicist work on the satellite.
"Roger," Tran replied, breathing deeply.
Without warning, a brilliant flash stunned the astronauts, partially blinding them for a second.
"What the hell?"
Everyone instinctively flinched as they tried to adjust their minds to what was happening.
Snap! Flash!
Another bright light, like the flash of sunlight off a mirror, shocked the crew.
"Look!"
Crawford and Crisati reacted at the same instant, leaping back to the aft viewing port, blinking their eyes to clear the dots floating before their pupils.
"Oh,
Oh, God, no, Crawford said. All the crew members crowded the two viewing windows. They could not believe their eyes when they surveyed the carnage in the cargo bay. Dr. Min Tran had literally disappeared in the jumble of pieces gently floating away from the orbiter. Part of the vertical stabilizer was missing, along with a section of the right cargo door. Debris covered the cargo bay from the midsection aft to the damaged tail.
Houston, Columbia, we've been hit by something, Crawford radioed, staring at the annunciator panel. It was lighted like a Christmas tree. We've got an emergency. Copy, Columbia. State your emergency. Shit, we've been hit by something. I don't know what it was. Just a huge flash. Columbia, do you have cabin integrity? Yeah, we seem to at the moment. A different voice emitted from mission control. Columbia, recommend crew don their suits. What is the nature of your emergency? Something hit us. I don't know what it was, but it destroyed the aft section of the cargo bay and part of the stabilizer. Roger, Columbia. Get Dr. Tran inside the cabin and descend to lower orbit. We can't, Houston. Crawford's voice cracked. Well, what do you mean you can't? Dr. Tran is dead. Oh, no. Well, you're positive? That's a firm, Houston, Crawford responded, tasting bile in his throat. Send Allen to retrieve him and descend to lower orbit. We're analyzing the data now, Crawford swallowed. We can't retrieve Dr. Tran. His body disintegrated. He isn't aboard Columbia.
Ah, oh, Jesus.
Okay, get down to recovery orbit as soon as practical.
Roger, Crawford replied, turning to face the crew. Let's suit up and descend before we another blinding flash cut him short.
Oh, Crisati said, panic in his voice as he pointed to the annunciator panel. Fire!
The flight deck was chaotic as the astronauts scrambled to complete emergency procedures. Colonel Crawford, with the assistance of Ward Coldrew, began donning his spacesuit. Hank Doherty took command of the shuttle and initiated an emergency orbital change.
Columbia, Houston, the radio crackled. What's your status? We have normal cabin pressure and the electrical fires appear to be contained. No primary threat indications at present. We do have a major problem with the main hydraulic system. What's your problem, Columbia? We've lost complete system integrity. Must have ruptured a main line.
Columbia, Houston. Preliminary telemetry indicates you were hit by a particle beam weapon. We're ready to commence the recovery at this time.
Well, the Russians have got our number, Crawford replied.
The flight deck was quiet as Crawford programmed the shuttle for re-entry.
Hank, this is going to be difficult, Crawford said to the shuttle pilot. Houston, Crawford radioed, then made another entry into the computer.
RCS, dump completed.
Copy dump, Houston acknowledged. Our prayers are with you.
Thanks, Crawford responded.
Columbia, hurtling through space at 17,000 miles per hour, was absorbing the effects of the more dense atmosphere.
The shuttle was rapidly heating from the thermal shock of re-entry.
Houston, Crawford radioed, pulse pounding in his neck. We're at entry interface, ready for LOS.
Roger, Columbia. Copy ready for loss of signal.
The shuttle was approaching an altitude of 315,000 feet. Traveling at 16,700 miles per hour when the communications blackout began.
Columbia was enveloped by ionized particles during deep atmospheric entry.
Oh, shit, Crawford exclaimed as the orbiter decelerated to 15,000 miles per hour in the lower, denser atmosphere. I don't like the stiff feeling in the controls.
Crawford was intently concentrating on the flight instruments. The vibration is beginning to make this very difficult.
Watch your roll, boss.
Doherty reminded Crawford, noting the right wing had dropped 7 degrees.
Got it,
Crawford answered, then stared at the RCS pitch thruster's deactivated light. The bright light winked on. Columbia started to buffet, then oscillated in roll and pitch.
I don't like this, Crawford, obviously strained, said over the intercom. Stay with it, Doherty replied.
Crawford fought the controls, breathing heavily.
I'm losing it. Oh, God, I've lost it.
Dmitri and Wickham stared with terror-filled eyes as the other Russian gunship landed 50 meters from the first helicopter. The gunner crawled out and cautiously approached the Lada, then returned to confer with the gunship pilot. The second helicopter added power and hovered approximately 10 meters over the pavement. The Russian gunner remained close to the first gunship. After two complete circles, the second helicopter departed in the direction they had arrived from, following the road.
Dmitri, we've got a break, Wickham whispered. I'm sure the other bastard went after fuel. When he gets back, then this guy will go. They know we're in the vicinity. After they're both full of fuel and probably have reinforcements on the way, then they'll begin to hunt in earnest.
Wickham looked around the area, then turned back to his charge. We've got to move now. Get as much real estate between us and them as soon as possible. Okay, I'm ready. I'll be okay. Good. Follow me and stay on your stomach. We're going to crawl to that tree line, Wickham pointed in the direction, and then cut back across the road. Got it? Yes, Dimitri replied. Let's go. Real slow and easy, no quick movements, the American coached as the two agents belly crawled toward the distant tree line. Zelenkov, tired from his trip to Lajas, waited while the cardiologist closed his bag and walked through the huge doors of the Kremlin residence. The general secretary looked at the capsule of blood pressure medicine, then decided he needed a Stolichnaya on ice.
Well, comrades, the American space defense system is no longer fully operable. Our plan will work without question. We will pull back, then mount a massive first strike as soon as the Americans return to a normal status.
Zelenkov smiled, pleased with his efforts. The Politburo members did not appear convinced.
Well, what is your opinion, my friends? You do not seem to share my joy.
Comrade Zelenkov, we are very concerned, Puya, the senior Politburo member, said.
Concerned about what? The spy, the CIA agent planted here in your quarters. How did the blundering idiots at KGB allow that to happen? There is no need to worry. Colonel General Vranzivik, the GRU commander, assures me they have the spies contained. It is only a matter of time, comrades. What about the rest of your staff? How many other spies have infiltrated our vaults?
Zelenkov snorted.
They have been checked, all of them, and interrogated. There are no other spies, believe me. Now please, please relax. The American spy and our traitor will be caught. No information will leak out.
Zelenkov puffed on his cigar, then rose to his feet, walking slowly to the open bar. He poured a large quantity of Stolichnaya in a glass, then turned to his friends.
Comrades, trust me.
Just 5 or 6 more kilometers, Dimitri. We'll take a break in a few minutes.
Okay, Dimitri replied, breathing hard. Both agents walked another kilometer in silence, staying close to a collective farm. The American broke the silence. Dimitri, if we encounter anyone, let me do the talking. We had an accident and left our car. That's how we got in this shape. We'll still have our credentials, so... The American abruptly stopped, dropping to the ground on his hands and knees.
He motioned Dimitri to follow him.
The two men sprinted to a tree line and dove into the underbrush, breathing heavily.
What is it?
Dimitri asked.
You hear that? The choppers are back. The American looked back along their path.
Son of a bitch. They must have found where we crossed the road. Dimitri stared at the approaching helicopters. The Soviet Mi-28s were hugging the treetops, probing every foot of terrain.
Dimitri, they've got infrared sensors. We've got to get out of here.
I don't understand, Dimitri replied. What is infrared? They can spot body heat in total darkness, especially in cold conditions like this. Our only chance is to make a run for those animal pens. The agent pointed toward two fenced areas next to a feeding trough. It's dark enough for us to conceal ourselves in the middle of the pigs and sheep. We've got to blend our body temperatures in with the animals.
Dimitri nodded in silence.
Let's go, the American yelled as they crashed through the brush and sprinted to the edge of the pens. Both men, panting, lay flat on their stomachs next to the crude fence. They could hear the sound of the helicopters growing closer.
Okay, we've got to move slowly to the edge of the sheep. Can't scare them. The American paused to catch his breath.
Then we ease under the fence and remain still until the choppers are gone. The two Soviet gunships, searchlights ablaze, slowly tracked over the collective farm. Wickham and Dimitri watched, not moving, not breathing, as the closest Russian helicopter flew directly over the two animal pens. The glare of the spotlight blinded the agents as it slowly crossed the sheep enclosure.
The president stepped off the air-stair door of Marine One, smartly saluted the Marine sentry, and walked briskly into the White House. "Have we heard from the Soviet ambassador?" the president asked.
"Yes, Mr. President. He is on his way here along with the deputy foreign minister,"
Vice President Susan Blaylock responded. "Good," the president replied, then looked at Howard. "Cliff, explain to me what happened to our shuttle."
"Dr. Hayes at NASA has informed me approximately 30 minutes ago the Columbia was the target of Soviet laser weapons."
"How is the crew, Cliff? What are their chances of surviving the re-entry?"
"Dr. Hayes said the crew is fine at the moment, but they did lose the payload specialist. No one knows the odds for survival. Dr. Hayes was pessimistic, actually. He indicated NASA was preparing for the worst. They are flying the families to Houston as soon as possible."
The president addressed his staff.
"Lajas was a disaster, to put it succinctly. Grant and I believe Zelenkov is not mentally sound, and that scares us. Grant believes we should plan for the worst, even a preemptive strike." Loud murmurs filled the room. The president gestured to Wilkinson. "Will you run through our event sequence for us?"
"Yes, sir," Wilkinson responded. "The previous general secretary, a man of basic equanimity, died in a mysterious plane crash. Zelenkov, from the bowels of obscurity, was in power within hours. The Soviet economy is in complete shambles. The Russians have been deeply embarrassed twice by being caught violating the INFA treaty. The United States is about to jump at least a half a decade ahead in space-based missile defense technology." Wilkinson looked at Chambers. "Evidence indicates there has been a strong shift or fragmentation within the Politburo. The political direction of the Soviet Union has made a complete reversal during the past 4 weeks. The continuing decline of the Communist Party, in my thinking, is why we have seen the drastic changes in the Kremlin. The party has both feet in the coffin, and they are afraid that we are going to close the lid."
Wilkinson paused, then added the bottom line.
"We have a resurrected hardline fanatic under tremendous pressure to save the communist system, holding the match closer and closer to the fuse. Zelenkov wants to see if we'll flinch and use our extinguishers to put out the flame. If he gets it next to the fuse, as he has now, and we don't do anything, he is home free. Sure, Russia will take some hits, but they'll survive, and we'll be blasted into oblivion. Zelenkov will become the Soviet hero of the century, and the Communist Party will finally rule the globe. Zelenkov will blow out the match, laugh, watch us put away the extinguishers, then strike the fuse before we can react." Blaylock spoke first.
"Grant, I'm not the greatest military strategist, but if you are correct, it means we can't downgrade from our current posture and readiness."
"Precisely," Wilkinson replied.
"I'm open for recommendations," the president said. "We're going to have to respond in a firm manner. We will retaliate militarily to any future Soviet transgressions." The gunships continued on the search path. "Come on, easy, don't startle the sheep," Wickham said. "We've got to get near the pickup point and dig in." They started across the field. Light snow continued to fall in the black void of night, chilling the two agents to the marrow. Wickham and Dmitri, after stumbling in the dark for an hour and a half, finally reached the edge of the partially frozen river. Exhausted, the men collapsed on the bank, cold, frightened, and hungry. Dmitri heard the approaching trucks first.
"I hear some..."
"Shut up," the American snarled. Both agents, lying on their stomachs, crawled up the embankment to peer down the road through the underbrush. They could see a multitude of lights twinkling in the dark. "Keep your face down and smear it with dirt," the CIA agent ordered. "We're close, almost home, but we've got problems." Dmitri nodded. "Dmitri, that has to be the GRU. I'm sure they've got dogs with them. You hear them howling? That's the same way we came. They're right on our trail. Shit." Wickham leaned closer to Dmitri. "We're going to cross the road, make a large circle, then cross back to the same position. We'll retrace our steps, then cross the river, make the other side upstream, and head for the rendezvous point." Wickham listened a moment, then again spoke to Dmitri. "We're going to freeze our asses, but it'll throw the dogs off our trail for a while." The American paused, observing no reaction from Dmitri.
Better than a goddamn firing squad. Let's move out. The two men scrambled up the bank and completed a large circle. Both agents ran back to their original position, then slid into the ice-cold water as quietly as possible. The numbing cold literally took their breath from them.
Okay, Dimitri. Just dog paddle. Stay with me.
Okay, baby, Lieutenant Commander Doug Frogman Carnes said to himself, passing 300 knots indicated airspeed. Here we go. The Tomcat smoothly rotated skyward, climbing vertically. Carnes turned on his scrambler, then tuned to the E-2C Hawkeye's frequency. Stingray, gun one up, flat of two, standard ordnance, squawking. What have you got? Right turn, heading 230 and climb to angle 31, the Hawkeye controller ordered. Two Air Force F-15s tangling with a division of MiG-29s due east of the Iceland MADIZ. Four MiGs jumped them just outside of the zone, and the 15s dropped one of the MiGs. The Eagles had to disengage because of low fuel, so we're vectoring you for an intercept.
Roger,
Carnes radioed as he slowly lowered the nose, pulled the throttles out of the afterburner, and turned to the southwest heading. He looked over his right shoulder in time to see Hirschberger slide smoothly into a nice, loose parade position.
Two's aboard, the lieutenant radioed. Looks like we're going to have some more fun with these assholes.
Afraid so, Carnes responded. Let's arm them up, switch is hot, and go on combat spread. The Eisenhower's Combat Information Center broke in.
Gunfighter flight, you have permission to engage. Repeat, you have permission to engage. White House authority.
Roger, Tango, Fox, gunfighters engaging.
Guns, Stingray. Bogies are jinking back at... Turning into you.
We've got them, Carnes radioed. Stand by, Hirsch.
Roger.
Both pilots watched the MiGs close rapidly.
Tally 10 miles, Carnes radioed to Gun 2.
Stand by.
Fire!
Both pilots squeezed off AIM 7mm Sparrow missiles and prepared to counter the Russians' evasive maneuvers.
Fox 1,
Carnes yelled as he watched the two missiles track straight for the Soviet fighters. He could see the MiGs snap into a high turn at 7 miles.
Bogey's breaking right.
The lead fulcrum disintegrated in a mushroom of orange and black explosions. The second Sparrow missed and flew out of sight.
Let's go high, Carnes ordered,
seeing the MiGs turn hard to his left.
Switch into guns.
Carnes rolled almost inverted, pulling the nose down to the horizon, then further below to track the second MiG.
Check 6, Komaradsky,
the Top Gun graduate said under his breath. He was almost in the perfect firing solution. Almost.
Idling boards,
Carnes warned.
He's trying to get me to overshoot. This son of a bitch, he is good. We're dropping anchor, Ivan.
Carnes groaned under the punishment he was imposing on the straining F-14.
Carnes pulled even harder, feeling the stall buffet as he closed inside the Russian.
He had a perfect gunshot.
Say good night, comrade,
Carnes said as he squeezed the firing button. Three short bursts erupted from the forward fuselage of the F-14. Carnes and his backseater, Bonicelli, watched as the entire tail was engulfed in flames. The MiG then slow-rolled to the left as the nose fell through the horizon.
Good hit,
Carnes radioed.
Watch it, Frog,
Hirschberger yelled over the radio.
The other asshole is bouncing you. Low, at your 8 o'clock.
Tally, Carnes shouted. A split second later, the flaps were retracted as Carnes turned into his adversary with a 7G effort.
I've got him. Rolling in, Hirschberger radioed.
Now don't get too close, Carnes warned Gun 2.
You're almost up his ass.
Hirschberger didn't answer as he continued to hose down the MiG driver with his smoking Vulcan.
I'm in, Carnes said,
snap rolling the F-14 to catch the MiG in his sights.
He's got it recovered. One of his burners is out.
Carnes placed the gun sight on the nose of the fulcrum, then squeezed the trigger twice. The MiG's canopy disintegrated as the pilot slumped forward.
Good kill, Carnes radioed. Bring it aboard, Hirsch,
he said, then addressed the carrier.
Gun 1 and 2 coming home.
Brad Buchanan watched the radar altimeter warning light blink on and off.
Keep an eye on me, John.
Got you covered, the co-pilot responded. The three Nighthawks, painted in Russian camouflage, raced across the Gulf of Finland, due south of Helsinki. Buchanan, call sign Scarecrow 1, had his hands full maintaining exactly 50 feet over the turbulent ocean while traveling at 170 miles per hour. Coast coming up in 7 minutes, John Higgins, the co-pilot, announced to Buchanan. The Nighthawk combat rescue helicopter carried two other crew members behind the cockpit. Blackie Oakes, the crew chief, and Steve Lincoln, paramedic, doubled as door gunners. The three Nighthawk crews had been briefed to keep radio silence, except in the case of an emergency, during their run to the rendezvous point near Novgorod. I've got the pad in sight, Buchanan informed his crew, then banked slightly to the right. Everyone knew this would be a quick turn, engines running, then back into the air for the dash to Novgorod. The Nighthawks would traverse the entire route at an altitude of 200 feet or lower. The only hitch would be towers or power lines not on their charts. The General Secretary removed his shoes and stared at the crackling fire.
It is good to be home, comrades, Zelenkov smiled.
It is good to be with you, comrade, the elder statesman replied. The six men present joined in a toast, spilling vodka as the glasses loudly banged together. A discreet chime interrupted the group. Zelenkov was surprised to see Colonel General Vereznevich, the GRU commander, standing at the door.
Come in, comrade general, Zelenkov yelled. You have good news for us, eh?
Comrade General Secretary, I regret to inform you.
Relax, General. Have a Stolich Naya with us.
Sir, I am afraid I have unpleasant news to report about the two American...
What unpleasant news? Zelenkov bellowed. You cannot find these spies.
Sir, we have the spies contained. It is only a matter of time before we kill them.
Then, what is the problem?
Vereznevich coughed.
We interrogated the two women at the restaurant where the spies were initially contacted. The old woman overheard the two spies talking in the kitchen. She speaks reasonable English. She testified, under pressure, that your domestic, the Kremlin resident, reported to the American of your intention to bomb the United States.
Zelenkov shoved himself forward in the big easy chair, knocking his drink over.
Who else knows about this?
Only two of my men, sir. And the two restaurant workers, the women, all four are in my office now. They have not talked with anyone, I assure you. My office is under guard until my return, sir.
You had better be right, General, Zelenkov said.
Comrade General, you will terminate the two women immediately and confine your two men in isolation until you hear from me. Do you understand clearly, General?
Yes, your orders will be carried out immediately, sir. Vereznevich started to rise.
Sit down, General,
Zelenkov ordered. The Politburo members exchanged dour looks, but remained silent. Zelenkov leaned forward again.
Only the seven of us in this room know, or will know, about our operation. Correct, General?
Yes, sir, Vereznevich replied.
I understand completely, sir. Not completely, General. Zelenkov responded. You will rue this day if the cowardly spies are not dead by this time tomorrow. 24 hours, General, or I will personally see you executed. Do you understand?
Yes, Comrade General Secretary, I will take my leave and personally see to the...
24 hours, General.
The GRU officer quickly rose from the couch and rushed for the doors. As the massive doors closed, Zelenkov turned to his cortege.
We will be okay. Our plan is intact, my friends.
Both agents lay sprawled on the riverbank, shivering and gasping for air. Hear the dogs? Wickham whispered to Dmitri. The young agent cocked his head, shaking uncontrollably in his freezing clothes. The dogs have found our circle.
That's right,
Wickham responded. We've got to get into the brush. Dmitri crawled after the American. The barking seemed to intensify as the dogs ran back and forth around the false trail left by the CIA agents. A large Soviet-armored personnel carrier arrived at the scene and disgorged a dozen elite GRU troops. Dmitri was shaking violently as he stared at the scene across the river. Come on, Dmitri, Wickham encouraged. Just a little longer. You've got to hang on, Wickham stopped in mid-sentence. Oh, Jesus. The American's voice trailed off in weariness, then resurged. Dmitri, the choppers are returning. The distinct sound was clearly the two MI-28 Havocs. Wickham felt he was in the grasp of defeat. If the Nighthawk rescue team roared into this ambush, which seemed inevitable, no one would survive. Dmitri could hear the rhythmic beat of the Soviet gunships approaching the growing contingent of GRU troops. The helicopter's bright halogen spotlights turned the scene into a surrealistic nightmare. Wickham turned to the inert young operative. Dmitri, we've got to get back in the water. The debilitated agent tilted his head up, vainly trying to focus on Wickham. You're crazy, he sputtered. The American slapped Dmitri across the face with his left hand, almost losing his balance as he sat upright in his stiffening coat. God damn it, Wickham spat in Dmitri's face. They've got infrared. They've got to dissipate our body heat until the chopper passes over us. The American grabbed the young agent by his collar. We'll only be in the water a minute or so, Wickham explained, dragging Dmitri down the muddy bank. You'll have to hold on to me. I can't move my right arm, Wickham continued, skidding on his buttocks while he pulled his heavy burden down the bank and into the frigid, ice-packed water. Dmitri, when I tell you now, I want you to hold your breath and duck under the water with me. Wickham received no answer, only unintelligible moans. You've got to duck under the water, Dmitri. Understand? For just a couple of seconds. Wickham glanced over his shoulder at the approaching Soviet gunship, engines pulsating in the black night. Now! Wickham yelled, sucking in his breath and submerging with Dmitri in his grasp. Wickham opened his eyes to a completely void, black world. Time seemed to pass in slow motion. The seconds became eternity as Wickham's lungs ached. His mind told him to hang on for a moment longer. The water suddenly seemed to glow, then turned bright as Wickham realized the gunship's spotlight was sweeping their position. He could see a multitude of particles and organisms drifting lazily in front of his eyes. Wickham was caught unprepared when Dmitri wrenched his arm loose and lunged for the river's surface. The three Nighthawks raced across the Gulf of Finland. The pilots watched their radar altimeters and scanned the flight instruments. Landfall would be in 11 minutes, 35 seconds.
Look clear between here and the coast, John? Buchanan asked his co-pilot.
John Higgins, without taking his eyes from the radar screen, replied,
Don't see a thing, Buck.
Good, Buchanan answered. Blackie, you and Steve ready?
You bet, Major, the former Marine gunnery sergeant replied. Just like old times.
Buck, looks like a possible 2 o'clock, 8 miles, Higgins reported.
Christ, Buchanan replied, just what we need.
Yeah, Buck, it's a ship, all right, Higgins replied. We better come left 20 degrees and see if we can skirt around it.
The crew of Scarecrow 1 remained quiet, listening to the powerful throb of the big turboshaft engines. Suddenly, Higgins gasped.
Oh, shit, they got a radar lock on us.
Buchanan heard the same electronic warning tone in his helmet.
The ruse must be over, eight gents.
Buchanan looked back at his crew.
Hold on, we may have to do some violent maneuvering.
Major, Oakes said. 10 to 1 that some bitch is a Russian trawler.
Probably so, Buchanan answered, knowing Oakes was right. The Nighthawks had been discovered. The Soviet intelligence gathering and surveillance vessel had been headed for the island of Kronstadt when the radar operator detected the unidentified helicopters. After repeated efforts to communicate with the suspicious intruders, the captain of the Gangushkino radioed the Soviet Air Force Northwestern Air Sector Control. The Russian Air Defense Commander launched 7 gunship helicopters from the Coast Aviation Brigade. The captain of the Gangushkino continued to relay position and heading information to the Air Defense Command Post until the unidentified helicopters disappeared in radar ground clutter after crossing the beach. 2 of the Soviet gunships were already airborne when Scarecrow 3 raced low across the Russian shoreline. The Soviet deputy foreign minister, trailed by the Russian ambassador, walked briskly into the situation room.
Please have a seat,
Kohlhammer gestured to the end of the expansive table. The president spoke to the Soviet deputy foreign minister first. Mr. Sharsharansky, your government is responsible for placing the United States in a position of imminent nuclear confrontation. In addition, General Secretary Zelenkov is responsible for the deaths of 23 American servicemen. He is also responsible for causing severe damage to our space shuttle and for the death of one of our astronauts. Skoronshansky blinked his eyes several times before responding. Mr. President, I am not at liberty to discuss these issues. We have been informed that our government is only responding to American aggression. We have no comment. The president glared at the Soviets. I am formally requesting that you contact General Secretary Zelenkov here and now on your direct line and explain our position. We are not budging another inch, you understand? The president was pleased to see both Russian nod in acknowledgement. General Secretary Zelenkov and the Soviet government have 6 hours to turn everything around. Everything. For your clarification includes bombers, submarines, tanks, and troops. Everything. The president folded his hands on the table. If Zelenkov doesn't comply, the Soviet Union can anticipate immediate retaliation. The room remained silent until the president spoke again. Do you have any questions?
No questions, Mr. President.
The president motioned to Kohlhammer. Herb, get the Kremlin on the line and make Mr. Sharsharansky comfortable. The CIA agent yanked violently on Dmitri's pant leg, slowing the panicked agent from surfacing until the spotlight had passed over their position. Dmitri surfaced, coughing and gagging as the Soviet Havoc gunship continued to sweep the river with its powerful halogen lamp.
Wickham surfaced a second after Dmitri and began tugging the gasping agent toward shore.
Come on, Dmitri, Wickham pleaded. You've got to hang on.
Wickham struggled to his knees in the mud and broken ice, then helped Dmitri to his knees. Both men crawled up the muddy embankment, shaking from the numbing cold, and rolled into the shelter of the shrub trees. Wickham jerked around, not quite sure of what he had heard. The night was ink black.
You hear that, Dmitri? Wickham asked.
There it is again. Wickham waited a couple of seconds, listening. That was a splash. Let's go. Wickham nudged Dmitri, then pointed downstream. We've got to move out. Get further away.
They're gaining on us.
Dmitri shoved himself up to his hands and knees.
Okay,
Dmitri replied, looking over his shoulder at the inflatable rubber boat being placed in the water at their original point of entry into the river. The three Nighthawks were 20 kilometers west of the Gatchina when Scarecrow 3 detected two fast-moving radar blips approaching the S-70s. Captain James Charbonnet decided it was time to break radio silence.
Scarecrow lead 3, Charbonnet said into his microphone. Mother-in-law at 1600,
he referred to bogies approaching from the four-cock position.
Okay, Buchanan replied. 2 and 3, go high and engage.
2 with the copy,
Pete Barnes radioed.
3,
Charbonnet said. Buchanan looked at Higgins. How long till we get to Novgorod?
14 minutes, Buck.
John, go ahead and broadcast Scarecrow identification for our agents.
Roger,
Riggins said, then pressed the transmitter key on the discrete frequency radio.
Scarecrow calling Sandman. Scarecrow 1 to Sandman.
The receiver remained quiet, emitting occasional broken static. Higgins adjusted the volume.
Try every 30 seconds or so, Buchanan ordered. We gotta have contact.
Will do, Higgins answered.
Buck, the cat is out, Pete Barnes radio's leader.
Roger, pistol.
Buchanan replied.
Pump the bastards and rejoin ASAP.
Coming to ya.
Barnes groaned under the G-forces as he pulled up steeply, performed a wingover, then dove into an attack position on the nearest Russian gunship. The Soviet pilots, caught off guard by the frontal assault, countered with a steep upward spiral, oblivious to Scarecrow 3. Charbonnet raised the nose of his S-70, turned into and under the Soviet Mi-28 Havoc combat helos, then loosed a salvo of air-to-air missiles. Both Russian gunships exploded. We splashed both intruders and we're on our way, Barnes reported. Wilkinson watched Sharkaransky tentatively accept the Moscow direct line telephone. The president suddenly turned to Herb Kohlhammer. Get the linguist, the Russian interpreter, in here. Yes, sir, Kohlhammer responded. Sharkaransky winced when a burst of Russian shot through the phone receiver. Sharkaransky explained the extreme situation in Russian to the Soviet general secretary, then fell silent. The interpreter, skipping the profanity, repeated both sides of the conversation.
Comrade General Secretary, Sharkaransky said, I am making an attempt to convey the situation as it is. The
telephone line went dead as a chagrined and humiliated Boris Sharkaransky hung up the phone. He spoke slowly, haltingly.
The General Secretary will comply with the wishes of the United States.
The President stood up. Thank you for your efforts, gentlemen. You may have made a significant contribution. Both Russians nodded in acknowledgement, then quietly walked out the door.
Well, the president exhaled, then sat down. We'll see what the next few hours bring.
An Army lieutenant colonel serving as a White House aide was conferring with Blaylock. His face was a grim mask of pain. The president, noticing the exchange, spoke to his vice president.
What is it, Susan?
Blaylock thanked the officer, then turned toward the president as the aide left the room.
Gentlemen, you better have a seat. I have some bad news to report. We have lost the shuttle, Blaylock said. Columbia crashed into the water off Southern California. They are launching search and rescue efforts at this time, but the SAR people and NASA don't have much hope of finding any survivors.
The president turned to the Secretary of Defense.
Cliff, I want the Navy to sink the three Soviet submarines off the coast of Florida.
Mr. President, the General Secretary is backing off. I am not sure we want to send the wrong message at this crucial time.
Yes, the President said, and Zelenkov knows our shuttle crashed because he ordered it attacked, along with the Tennessee, the Virginia, and our fighter planes. Order the attack.
The snow had begun to fall more heavily as the two CIA agents struggled along the edge of the riverbank. Wickham was startled to hear his miniature radio receiver transmit a message. Sandman, do you read? Scarecrow, do you copy Sandman? Hurry, Dimitri, they're here. Wickham encouraged the young agent to move up the embankment faster. Scarecrow calling Sandman, Higgins called. Come in, Sandman. Buchanan looked at his co-pilot.
If they aren't there, shit, we may get gamma-rooshed for nothing.
Yeah, Higgins keyed the intercom. They may already be dead, and we're going into a trap, Buchanan finished. Scarecrow 1 to Sandman, Higgins said into the radio. Copy, Sandman. Wickham pulled on Dimitri's coat sleeve as hard as he could with his left arm. The young operative finally struggled over the lip of the riverbank and rolled under a clump of low shrub trees. Wickham tugged at the combination radio homing beacon, folded out the antenna, flipped the automatic direction finder to the on position, then transmitted over the radio. Scarecrow, this is Sandman, over.
Sandman, the surprised voice responded immediately.
Stand by 1.
We can't stand by. We're surrounded by Russians.
Okay, Sandman, Higgins radioed. We've got a sweet beacon. Hang on. We're 7 out and rapidly closing on your position. Wickham could hear the sound of the engines and beat of the rotors over the radio. The senior agent turned to Dimitri and spoke reassuringly.
7 miles out, 3 minutes at the outside. Sweet Jesus, we're going to make it.
Now take off your coat and get ready to run. Your sole mission is to concentrate on getting into that chopper, okay?
Yes, Dimitri replied, shaking violently. That's all I want to do.
Wickham looked down river at the inflatable raft. They had reached shore, and two dogs were leaping from the boat to the muddy edge of the river. Wickham pressed the radio transmit key again.
Scarecrow, Sandman, urgent.
Copy, Sandman, Higgins replied.
Go.
Be advised, there are approximately 40, maybe 50 ground troops around us, plus 2 helicopters.
Say type of helicopters, Higgins said.
Gunships, Havocs, I believe, Wickham responded.
I think they're low on fuel.
Good, Higgins replied. Hang in there, Sandman. We're almost there.
We're trying to, Wickham said, watching the 6 advancing troops and their dogs.
Buchanan leaned towards Higgins.
Ask Sandman his exact position and see if he can describe the disposition of the ground pounders, Buchanan said. Scarecrow flight, listen up, Buchanan ordered the other two command pilots. We've got two gunships and approximately 50 grunts on top of our troops. Two, you jump the gunships, Buchanan ordered, and three, you strafe the troops.
Two,
Barnes replied.
Three will take the troops,
Charbonnet responded. Two, you break off now and hit the gunships broadside, Buchanan instructed.
Copy, Buck,
Barnes said.
Here we go.
Three, you stick with me and keep their heads down while I go in, Buchanan ordered Scarecrow Three.
Right on your tail,
Charbonnet replied. Higgins pressed the intercom switch. Most of the troops are on the east side of the river between the road and the riverbank. We'll just have to grab them the best we can, Buchanan muttered. I may not be able to land, so we better prepare to haul them in from a hover or use the ladder.
Yeah, no problem, Higgins answered.
One other detail, Buck. They've got troops and dogs closing on them on their side of the river.
Jesus,
Buchanan replied. This is turning into a major cluster. The pilot's statement was cut off as Scarecrow 2, traveling at a high rate of speed, flashed into view, spewing cannon shells at the Russian helicopters. We're coming up to the river now, so let's pick it up, Buchanan radioed Charbonnet.
Three is accelerating. Got you in sight, Charbonnet replied.
Scarecrow 2 rocketed between the two Soviet helicopters in a hail of ground fire. Buchanan keyed his intercom.
Gunny, you engage the troops on the far side of the river while Steve handles the guys closing on our agents.
Will do, Major, Oakes replied.
Higgins was yelling over the discrete frequency to Wickham.
You'll have to guide us over your position, copy?
Speak up. We can't hear you. You'll have to guide us in.
Ping! Thud!
Two rounds hit the aft left side of the main cabin. One penetrated the fuselage, missing Lincoln by 3 inches, while the other ricocheted upward into the rotor blades.
We're taking rounds, Major, Oakes said over the intercom.
Big stuff.
And better slow it down, Higgins told Buchanan, pointing to a spot across the river from the planned rendezvous point.
There they are, I think.
Yeah, I have them, Buchanan responded.
Shit, the grunts are almost on top of them.
Buck, Higgins glanced at the commander of Scarecrow One. This don't look so good.
Dimitri lay spread-eagled in the shrubs as Wickham frantically gave instructions over the small radio.
You're about 150 yards away, straight ahead along the shore, Wickham yelled into the radio.
Dimitri, Wickham shouted,
fire in the vicinity of the troops.
Wickham pulled out his Beretta and aimed in the general direction of the advancing Soviet troops.
You're only 100 yards away, Wickham shouted into the radio.
Straight ahead.
Sing!
The high-powered round ricocheted off a tree 2 yards from the agents, causing both men to drop prone on the frozen ground.
Dimitri, Wickham barked, start crawling towards the chopper.
Go! Go!
Dimitri dropped his weapon and started crawling on his hands and knees. Wickham turned towards the Russian and froze in panic when he saw one of the killer dogs snarling just 20 feet away.
Oh, shit,
the agent said quietly as he gripped the Beretta with both hands, aimed at the middle of the dark, growling canine, and squeezed the trigger. The Doberman staggered backwards, fell over a stump, and died. Wickham fired the remaining rounds at the advancing Russians, then dropped the Beretta and started crawling after Dimitri.
Keep moving. Go!
Wickham yelled at the struggling figure in front of him. A helicopter thundered into the ground next to the roadway.
Sandman! Sandman!
Higgins urgently radioed, trying to expedite the rescue effort.
We've got to set down here. It's the only clear spot. Can you make it?
Wickham looked up, judged the distance to be 60 yards at most, then frantically keyed his transmitter.
Yeah, on our way. We need cover fire.
The CIA agent grabbed Dimitri by the collar.
Come on, run,
Wickham shouted, racing for the settling Nighthawk.
Run, Dimitri.
50 yards, Wickham judged as the two men stumbled through the low shrub trees.
40 yards, just 40 yards, Wickham shouted to Dimitri.
His arm and shoulder shot excruciating pain through his body every time his right foot hit the ground. Wickham forced his mind to block the pain as he stumbled through the shrubs. Buchanan saw a stream of fire trailing along another helicopter on the far side of the river. Tracer rounds continued to pour from the stricken gunship as it slowly rolled over and flew into the muddy river.
Run! Run!
Lincoln screamed as Wickham fell over the back of Dimitri.
Move it! Go!
Wickham cried breathlessly as parts from the crashed helicopter rained down amid the chaos.
20 yards! Wickham shouted to Dimitri.
Then forcefully shoved the young CIA operative.
Major,
Oakes shouted over the intercom.
Three is in the river. Some got out.
Buchanan yelled over the intercom.
Keep them covered, Gurney.
Wickham and Dimitri reached the side of the Sikorsky as Lincoln jumped out to assist in boarding. Dimitri fell, picked himself up, then reached for the door as Lincoln thrust him bodily into the cabin.
Wickham shoved on Dimitri, too, as the young agent rolled sideways into the fuselage. Wickham reached up, grabbed the door, lifted his leg, then stopped in mid-stride as if someone had hit him in the back with a sledgehammer. He fell into the side of the fuselage, then rolled on his side, moaning. Lincoln grabbed the agent and yelled for Gunny Oakes. Buchanan was shouting into the cabin as Oakes leaped out to help Lincoln get the CIA operative into the helicopter.
"What about three?" Higgins shouted. "We can't just leave him there."
"God damn it, I know that," Buchanan shot back, raising the Nighthawk into the air, then pivoting around to face the river as Oakes scrambled aboard after Lincoln. Wickham was laying face down on the floor, bleeding profusely from the back wound.
"Pete, cover me while I try to get Jim's crew out," Buchanan ordered, as he eased the Sikorsky toward the far riverbank and turned so Lincoln would have a better view of the downed crew. "Pete, spray the shoreline left of the gunship wreckage." Buchanan could clearly see the crashed S-70 as he crossed the riverbank. "We've got survivors in the water. They're on the side of the Hawk."
"I see him," Barnes replied, then fired a stream of cannon fire down the length of the riverbank.
"Lower the chair," Buchanan commanded, inching closer to the twisted wreckage. "Keep up the fire, Gunny."
"You got it, Major," Oakes replied, raking the shoreline with his M-60. Buchanan maneuvered the nimble Sikorsky over the downed sister ship. He could see the three people hanging from the side of the overturned helicopter, clinging to a twisted rotor blade.
"We're going to be heavy, Major," Lincoln said over the intercom.
"Who gives a shit?" Buchanan barked. "We aren't leaving anyone."
"The gunny's hit," Lincoln shouted as Oakes slumped to the floor, holding his stomach, then fell forward in a heap.
"Take his place," Buchanan yelled.
"Keep firing. Keep the pressure on."
Ping! A round hit the helicopter, slightly behind the co-pilot's head, causing him to jump.
"Jesus!" Higgins exclaimed.
"John," Buchanan ordered, "help Lincoln get him aboard before we all go in."
Higgins nodded, unfastened his seat restraints, then crawled back into the cabin of the S-70. Buchanan could see the three-pronged seat banging into the side of the downed Sikorsky.
"Come on, guys," he said under his breath as he stabilized the Nighthawk over the crew in the freezing water.
"Move it!"
Lincoln could see Charbonnet helping someone onto the chair. Time seemed to pass in slow motion as the Nighthawk's rotor blades whipped the surface of the muddy river into a frothy gale. Higgins coughed. Lincoln looked at Higgins a split second after the co-pilot took a round through his neck. The paramedic watched horrified as Higgins dropped to his knees, clutched his bleeding throat, then fell through the open side door. Higgins' body bounced off the tail rotor of the downed gunship, then disappeared under the surface of the churning water. Lincoln pressed the retrieval switch on the hoist, then contacted Buchanan.
"Major, Captain Higgins is dead."
"What?" Buchanan shouted, concentrating on the rising rescue chair.
"The captain's dead, sir," Lincoln yelled, looking at Dimitri. "I'm going to put the CIA guy on the 60.
"Do it," Buchanan barked, then glanced back down at the chaotic struggle going on below the Sikorsky. Lincoln motioned to the machine gun and ordered Dimitri to take the position.
"Start firing. Aim for the far bank. Just keep it moving."
Dimitri responded slowly, inching towards the M-60 as Lincoln grasped one of the gunners from Scarecrow 3 and pulled him into safety. More rounds impacted the hovering helicopter as the shocked paramedic quickly lowered the rescue seat into the maelstrom below.
Bazing!
Buchanan involuntarily flinched as the small arms round ricocheted off the side of the cockpit. He already had two holes in the windshield and one near his right foot. Dimitri fired at the riverbank in wild bursts. He was too cold to hold the machine gun steady, too tired to care. Finally, after the ammunition ran out, Dimitri stopped pulling the trigger and looked at Lincoln. The paramedic, busy operating the hoist, kicked the loose M-16 across the floor, hitting Dimitri in the shins.
"Use it," Lincoln yelled at the agent.
Lincoln pulled the slightly injured co-pilot into the cabin and immediately tossed the rescue seat out the door.
"One to go, Major,"
Lincoln reported, glancing down at Blackie Oakes. "Hang in there, kid," the former gunnery sergeant said in a raspy voice, choking from the blood in his throat.
"Pete," Buchanan shouted over the radio, "I need more fire on the riverbank north of the gunship."
"Rolling in now, Buck," Barnes reported, sweeping low. He switched to guns and sprayed the entire group of Russian troops.
"Come on, Jim," Buchanan said to himself as he watched Charbonnet embrace the rescue seat, then push off the side of the downed Nighthawk.
There was no sign of the fourth crewman. Buchanan, breathing a sigh of relief, added more power and penetration for the transition to forward flight.
Psing!
Another round careened off the side of the cockpit, creating a crack in the windscreen directly in front of Buchanan.
"We're going to move out," Buchanan shouted to Lincoln. "I'll slow down so you can get him in when we clear the fire zone."
"Yes, sir," the paramedic replied as the S-70 began to accelerate and climb into the darkness. Buchanan looked down at the same instant. Charbonnet, 15 feet below, slumped forward into the cable, rolled off the seat, and plummeted 70 feet into the riverbank. The pilot was dead before he impacted the thick mud. "Pete," Buchanan radioed, "we lost Jim. Cover us."
"Got you in sight," Barnes radioed. "We've got company. Gunships, 4-5, closing like bats out of hell."
"Stick tight, Pete," Buchanan ordered.
"They're closing on us, Captain,"
the crew chief of Scarecrow 2 yelled.
"Buck, they got a running start on us," Barnes radioed. "I'm going to have to slow 'em down. Open up,"
Barnes shouted to his gunners as a Hind D exploded directly in front of the Sikorsky, lighting the night for a mile in every direction.
"Holy shit,"
Barnes yelled, pulling hard on the collective. The S-70 shot skyward, silhouetted in the flaming explosion, then rolled almost inverted. Barnes lined up a shot at another Hind D as the Russian gunship raced past him. "Steady on," Barnes said to himself as he prepared to squeeze the firing button. That was the last thought Pistol Pete Barnes would ever have. The Russian gunner in the lead Havoc had placed his second SA-14 missile into the inlet particle deflector of the S-70's right engine. The ensuing explosion decapitated both pilots. The spinning helicopter plunged straight down, plowing into the ground in a thunderous fireball. Steve Lincoln watched in total disbelief as Scarecrow 2 exploded on impact.
"Captain Barnes went in, sir," Lincoln shouted into the intercom.
"I know," Buchanan replied. Dimitri, shivering uncontrollably, crawled next to Wickham, who was breathing in shallow, quick gasps.
"We're on our way," Dimitri said to Wickham. "You'll be okay as soon as we..."
"Dimitri," Wickham interrupted, "tell the pilot to get your message out. Top priority."
"Okay," Dimitri responded.
"What'd he say?" Lincoln asked.
"The pilot, can he send a message, an important message, to Washington?"
"Yeah," Lincoln replied, glancing back to the Soviet helicopters. "But now ain't a good time. Wait till we shake these guys, then I'll ask."
"Okay,"
Dimitri responded, then looked at Wickham. Wickham looked dead. His eyes, still open, had rolled back almost out of sight.
"No,"
Dimitri cried, totally devastated.
"Oh, no."
The agent, tears rolled down his cheeks, slowly pulled the blood-soaked blanket up over Wickham, covering his head. Dimitri couldn't see that his friend, Steve Wickham, had only passed out but was still breathing. "You might as well cover the gunny, too," the rescue co-pilot said as he struggled to enter the cockpit. "He died a couple of minutes ago." Suddenly, two bright streaks raced past the Nighthawk, lighting the interior.
"Christ!" Buchanan shouted. "Here come the missiles!"
"Use some help?" the co-pilot of Scarecrow 3 asked, climbing into the vacant seat.
"Damn right," Buchanan answered.
Two, three, then four more streaks of light went flashing by the racing Nighthawk.
"Link," Buchanan shouted, "can you get a shot, any shot, at those bastards?"
"I think so, sir," Lincoln replied.
Crack!
The S-70 slewed sideways, then righted itself as Buchanan frantically scanned the engine gauges.
"We've been hit," Lincoln groaned as he fell backwards, stumbling over the body of Blackie Oakes.
"Come, comrades," Zelenkov said to his ill-at-ease friends. "Let us enjoy these fine delicacies."
The general secretary motioned for the men to take a seat, then half fell into his large chair at the head of the massive wood table.
"Viktor Pavlovich," Dychinkov, his closest and oldest friend, said, "we need to talk with you about this plan." "What do you wish to talk about?" Zelenkov squinted menacingly. "You do not like, you do not have the stomach for this plan, for world dominance?"
Deadly silence filled the room. Puye cleared his throat.
"We think now is not the opportune time to attack the Americans. Their allies will counterattack us. We must allow time for a return to normal." "Left to you, my friend," Zelenkov smiled crookedly, "there would never be an opportune time. Victor, let us discuss this matter when we are refreshed and have a better assessment of the..." "We will discuss the matter now," Zelenkov said heartily, then downed his vodka. "You surprise me, my trusted friend. All of you. Look what I have accomplished. I am on the brink of global conquest."
Without warning, an aide urgently rapped on the door and stepped into the room. Zelenkov turned around in a rage.
"Damn it, Colonel, what is it?" Zelenkov yelled.
"General Secretary," the colonel pursed his lips, "the spies have escaped." Zelenkov turned crimson and hurled his tumbler at the wall, shattering glass across the room. "Out!" Zelenkov bellowed, enraged. "Get out! Get me Air Marshal Katsha Dovronian now!" The colonel, eyes wide in terror, back toward the open door. Zelenkov turned toward his fellow conspirators.
"General Valazinkvich is dead," Zelenkov yelled,
then clutched his chest and staggered to the couch. Buchanan, half turned in his seat, yelled to his new co-pilot, "What's the damage? The right gear. The missile took out the right gear and damaged the fuselage," the young pilot answered. Buchanan turned around and looked down and back from the cockpit. What he saw made him realize the helicopter might roll over on landing. The entire wheel and structural mounts were missing. Fuel streamed along the underside of the S-70's fuselage, vaporizing as it departed the tail assembly. The coast was only minutes away for Scarecrow One and her crew. Buchanan looked at the small chart strapped to his thigh. Buchanan's flight path was clearly defined, including known obstacles circled in dark rings. "How close are those bastards?" The co-pilot leaned out the side door. "Can't tell for sure, maybe a half to three-quarters of a mile." Buchanan looked at his chart again. "Well, I guess now is as good a time to let them close up." "What?" the young pilot responded. "You better be kidding, Major." Buchanan checked his chart again.
"Just watch," Buchanan answered the bewildered co-pilot. "Stand by with the 60 and hang on to your jockstrap."
There was no reply as Buchanan started to turn to the right. The maneuver would allow the Soviet gunships to turn inside the S-70, closing the range between the two combatants in a matter of seconds.
"Here we go," Buchanan said,
then rechecked his chart. The INS indicated only 7/10 of a mile to the four 800-foot communication towers, towers with many supporting guide wires fanning out in every direction.
"Come on, you communist bastards," Buchanan said quietly over the intercom.
3/10 of a mile, seconds away in the racing gunship.
"Be there," Buchanan said as he momentarily flicked on the landing lights.
"Hot damn," the pilot said. "Perfect!" Buchanan began to slowly tighten his turn around and in front of the massive towers, almost invisible under the dark, snow-laden clouds. "Major," the co-pilot shouted, "they're closing in fast."
"Good."
6 seconds passed as Buchanan's mouth turned dry.
"Come on," the pilot said to himself,
beginning to have a shadow of a doubt. A brilliant flash, followed by a nanosecond by another blinding flash, marked the end of the two Russian gunships. They had flown into the first two towers and supporting guide wires.
"God damn," the co-pilot yelled.
"You knocked two of the..."
A deafening report interrupted the co-pilot.
Another Soviet gunship flew into the guide wires of the fourth tower. The third explosion added flaming wreckage, raining down with secondary explosions to the huge conflagration enveloping the complex. The tall towers were collapsing in a slow-motion ballet.
"We're out,"
Buchanan whooped, turning back on course.
"Jesus, Major," the co-pilot paused. "I've seen a lot, but I've never seen anything to top this."
"Well, we ain't home yet," Buchanan responded.
"Damn, we're losing gas at a hell of a rate. Bet a line got punched when we took the hit."
Dmitri clambered to his feet, then approached the cockpit.
"Sir?"
Dmitri asked tentatively. Buchanan was startled by the agent.
"Yeah?"
the irritated pilot said. "What can I do for you?"
"Sir, I have been ordered to send a priority message to the White House, or to the Central Intelligence Agent..."
"Christ," Buchanan interrupted. "Which is it?"
"I guess I'd better send it to the White House," Dmitri stammered.
Buchanan leaned closer to his co-pilot. "You gotta be kidding me. This guy was a CIA agent in Moscow?"
"We'll send a top secret."
"Scrambled." Buchanan looked over at Dmitri. "Best we can do from the Hilo."
"Yes, sir," Dmitri replied. "That will be great."
"What's the message?" Buchanan asked Dmitri. The president and his staff, along with the joint chiefs, had reconvened in the Situation Room. Ted Corbin had been summoned to the room and looked nervous. The president, looking through his update folder, addressed Wilkinson.
"Grant, where do we stand?"
"Sir," Wilkinson said, standing up and turning to the global situation display facing the president, "our teal ruby satellites indicate numerous Soviet missiles and launch vehicles in the final stages of launch preparation, some with the submarines, sir." Soviet conventional forces are making a show of standing down, but the nuclear forces are still poised for a strike in these areas. The carrier Baku has joined the Kiev in the North Atlantic. They are in a position to strike anywhere in Europe or England. Sir, they've got us encircled. A soft buzzer sounded, interrupting the oppressive tension spreading through the room.
Yes,
the president responded, irritation written on his face.
What is it?
Mr. President, we have a top-secret scrambled message from Scarecrow One. The president, bewildered, looked at Grant Wilkinson.
Who the hell is Scarecrow One?
Corbin looked up, surprised. Scarecrow One is our rescue commander.
Patch him through, the president ordered.
Yes, sir, a soft voice replied. The feed is open, Mr. President. Mr. President, Brad Buchanan, commander of Scarecrow One, the pilot said.
We hear you, the president responded. Loud and clear.
Sir, the surviving agent we have on board has an urgent message to relay to... The president interrupted.
What do you mean, surviving agent?
Well, the other agent died from his wounds, sir, Buchanan explained, not knowing Wickham was still alive. We have him on board.
Please continue, the president said.
The surviving agent was the Kremlin operative, Buchanan paused. Mr. President, the agent states categorically that the Soviet General Secretary is going to launch a preemptive nuclear strike, a first strike, against the United States.
What? The president almost shouted. Let me speak with him.
I'll put him on, sir, Buchanan replied. A tentative voice came over the speaker.
Mr. President, my name is Leonard Volchik, and I have been...
Yes, go on, the president responded.
Dmitri inhaled deeply, then spoke.
I heard General Secretary Zelenkov say he's going to strike America with nuclear missiles.
Who did he say that to? The president asked.
Three of the Politburo members and a former member, Dmitri said. The defense minister was there, too, and the chief of general staff knows about the strike plans. No one else knows anything. Only the seven of them, sir.
Wait a moment, the president ordered, then turned to Corbin. How reliable is this agent? The president asked.
Sir, he is considered extremely reliable, Corbin said defensively. Dmitri was handpicked and has done an excellent job. He isn't a quick study, but he is absolutely loyal to the United States. He wouldn't make up something like this.
Okay, son, the president continued. When did you hear him make the comment about striking the United States?
Before he left for Lejas, Dmitri answered.
What precisely did the General Secretary say? The president asked.
He said that when the Soviet Union withdraws its forces, America would relax and Russia would strike with nuclear and chemical missiles. He said it would be very soon, Mr. President.
Okay, son, the president continued. Glad we got you out of there. You have performed well.
Thank you, Mr. President.
The speakers fell silent as the president stood up and walked around the table.
Go to DEFCON 1, the chief executive said.
Zelenkov had been placed in bed, his speech distorted by the massive stroke he had suffered only minutes before. The news had spread rapidly through the Kremlin hierarchy, but had been contained within the confines of the building. No one outside the Kremlin was to know anything.
Comrade, doctor, what are his chances for recovery?
Too early to tell, replied the physician.
Next 24 to 36 hours will tell us very much. He needs rest and this medication for the time being.
The doctor handed Pavlyev a small container of capsules. The Politburo members and the defense minister gathered around Zelenkov.
Dikchenkovko patted Zelenkov's limp hands.
Victor, the doctor says you will be fine.
Zelenkov's pale lips twitched in response.
You must rest for now. We will be with you.
Zelenkov rolled his eyes upward to focus on his friends.
Strike. America.
Zelenkov gurgled.
Oh, I will order. Yes, Victor,
Dikchenkovko replied, then encouraged the weaker leader to take a capsule. Zelenkov swallowed the medicine sluggishly, then looked up.
Now, strike now.
The youngest Politburo member, Nikolai Valinkin, discreetly motioned to his friends to step across the room.
Victor is going to carry out his plan, the newer member whispered. It is too soon to strike Americans. They are well prepared and could strike first. Calm yourself. We must have patience.
We will see him sleep a while, then we can discuss this matter with him.
Zelenkov lay quietly as he listened to the conversation of his co-conspirators. His mind, although medicated, was clear in his purpose, his goal. He would not be denied in his quest. Zelenkov knew it would be only a matter of hours before the course of world history would be altered forever. He would recover from his stroke and rule the entire planet. The President, Vice President, Chief of Staff, close cabinet members, and the military Joint Chiefs of Staff crowded into the White House Situation Room. Admiral Chambers spoke.
Sir, after analyzing all the data we currently have, along with the present Soviet nuclear status, I would conclude, I would have to say a Soviet first strike is a very real probability.
Wilkinson spoke slowly.
Sir, we, the Joint Chiefs, Clifford Howe and I, believe the United States would initiate a preemptive strike, a nuclear first strike, against the Soviet Union.
For God's sake, the President exploded, looking appalled at the thought.
You're serious? All of you?
Grant Wilkinson stretched both arms on the table, palms down.
Sir,
we are in a position from which we can't extricate ourselves. Gridlock, sir.
Jesus, Grant, said the President. You can't be serious.
Sir, Wilkinson continued, we have finally reached a point of no return. We can't go back to yesterday and put another Band-Aid on the problem. We have finally been placed in a no-win position. Wilkinson looked at Chambers, then back to the President. No recourse. Linkoff has only to give the order, and it will be carried out. Mr. President, you have the same prerogative. No one spoke a word. Sir, we don't have much time, Wilkinson said.
Zelenkov is a very mercurial person. We have no idea what he'll do next or when. We only know he is going to pull the trigger.
We just can't arbitrarily push the button and destroy the Soviet Union. The President looked perplexed.
We have to prize members of Congress, and,
sir, Wilkinson interjected. If we get Congress embroiled in this, you will be facing impeachment proceedings. We'll be in waist-deep in rubble before Congress even gets the hearings underway.
Mr. President, Zelenkov has the power to destroy us, and he is going to use it.
Cliff, the President said, what is your position on this matter? Howard addressed the President.
Sir, I can only reiterate what Grant said. The choice has been made for us. I urge you to initiate a preemptive strike on the Soviet Union.
Now, Mr. President, while we have a choice in the outcome, the future of this country, this nation, and its people rests on your decision, sir.
The doctor examined the general secretary, noting that he was conscious but not attempting to speak. He seemed to be in very stable condition and resting well.
Do you have any pain? The cardiologist asked, checking Zelenkov's vital signs.
Zelenkov moved his head very slowly, indicating no. I will check on you in another hour, comrade, the doctor said. Rest well and try to sleep.
As soon as he was gone, a military aide leaned over Zelenkov.
Comrade General Secretary, I am pleased to inform you that Colonel General Varziknik reports the spies have been killed. All three American helicopters were downed with no survivors. This has been confirmed, General Secretary.
Zelenkov, a faint smile spread across his sallow, craggy face, nodded. Colonel General Vereznovic had used the Holocaust at the communications towers to conceal the spies' escape. The carnage was unrecognizable as either American or Soviet, thus sparing his life and career. Zelenkov whispered to the aide, deeply slurring his words. He wanted his co-conspirators in his presence immediately.
Yes, Comrade General Secretary, the aide replied, standing erect at attention. Immediately.
The President looked haggard. Blaylock turned toward the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Admiral Chambers, before I go on record about this preemptive operation, I want to understand the details, the plan of action, if you will.
We, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, have reviewed this scenario from a tactical standpoint and conclude, unanimously, that a preemptive nuclear strike against the Soviet Union is feasible. We will prevail, no question about it.
What about Soviet submarines? The President asked.
We will be able to eliminate perhaps 40 to 50% of their submarines before they can respond, sir.
Our hunter-killer submarines and ASW aircraft are dogging them now.
What amount of damage can we expect to sustain?
Blaylock paused.
Realistically.
We'll receive considerable damage. Probably greater than our projections, to tell you the truth, Chambers answered. However, I can tell you it would be a fraction of the damage we will receive if the Soviets strike first. The Joint Chiefs are convinced, as are the Chief of Staff and the Secretary of Defense, the Soviet preemptive strike is imminent and inevitable, Mr. President.
Zelenkov is insane desperate, sir, Wilkinson said. We don't know when he will strike. We only know he intends to blast us into oblivion. We either strike first, Mr. President, or we become a nation that was.
The President addressed Admiral Chambers. You are convinced, along with the other military chiefs, that we have no other choice. We must launch a nuclear strike against the Soviet Union. You are totally, unequivocally convinced this course of action is in the best interest of the United States.
Yes, sir.
Grant, the President asked.
We have no choice, Wilkinson exclaimed.
Susan?
As painstaking as this is for me, for all of us, I agree with Grant and the Joint Chiefs, sir.
Cliff, the President looked across the table at his Secretary of Defense.
No other possible choice, sir.
The President stood. No one made a sound.
Start the plan in motion, the President said.
Zelenkov smiled slightly when his closest friend, Boris Dechinkovko, entered the room.
You are feeling better, Victor?
Yeah, much better. Our wonderful news has strengthened me, my friend.
Yes, the spies have been killed. Now, you must rest, my good friend.
No, comrades, Zelenkov said. Now we launch the strike on the United States. Give the order, General. This minute.
Victor, we must suspend our plan, for you have your orders, General. Carry out my command, or you will be relieved this minute.
General Secretary, as the ranking member of the Soviet Armed Forces, it is my duty to counsel you not to launch a strike at this...
The strike will be launched now, Zelenkov hissed. With or without you, General. Give the order, or I will have Colonel General Vranzivik place you in custody.
The order will be carried out.
The defense minister walked across the room to the private communications console and picked up the handset.
Give me the General Bogdanov.
The defense minister glanced at Zelenkov, then back out the window. 8 seconds passed before Bogdanov was on the line.
General Bogdanov, launch the strike. Operation Galaxy. General Secretary's orders. Launch the strike.
Okay, Admiral, the President said in a weary voice. The strike goes in 14 minutes. Tell me again what our priorities will be.
Yes, sir, Chambers replied. We're going to preempt the biggest weapons first. We're going after the SS-20s here, Chambers said, tapping each site on the map with his pointer.
We've got over 50% of their submarines, including the big boomers, under our thumb right now. We will dispatch them in 11 minutes, sir. The phone chimed. Wilkinson raised the receiver, nodded to Chambers, then spoke to the President.
All commands report ready and standing by, sir. Mr. President, the fighters have engaged the Soviet bombers over the Bering Sea.
Okay, the President replied, wiping perspiration from his hairline. He couldn't take his eyes off the clock as it slowly ticked off the final minutes to Armageddon. The Minuteman II nuclear missile silo felt like a cold burial vault to Captain Kevin Brostrom. He glanced over at his friend and fellow launch officer, First Lieutenant Teresa Langenilo.
It's authenticated and cleared, Brostrom said in a shaky voice. Stand by to insert keys.
Langenilo looked pale, almost chalky white. The two officers, members of the 44th Strategic Missile Wing, had practiced the situation hundreds of times. They had grown accustomed to believing a real launch order would never happen. Their minds couldn't cope with the destruction they were about to unleash. "In cert keys," Brostrom said in a weak voice. "Stand by to launch on command." Langenolo responded to the order, crossed herself, then began praying quietly. "3 minutes, Mr. President," Wilkinson reported in a haltingly dry voice. All eyes turned to the clock. 2 minutes, 40 seconds before the biggest tragedy in the history of mankind would begin. The president choked, then suppressed a sob.
"God forgive me, I have no other choice. Oh, Lord, I'm sorry."
Wilkinson took the president by the arm, not saying a word.
"Launch the strike,"
the president said weakly. The president, barely able to walk, was led out of the war room to a heavily fortified underground bomb shelter. His staff, with the exception of the Joint Chiefs, accompanied him to the reinforced quarters. As the entourage reached the bunker area, an aide, out of breath, rushed down the corridor.
"Yes, Colonel?"
Wilkinson said.
"Sir, Moscow is on the hotline."
"What?" Howard replied. "Couldn't be this soon." The aide ignored Howard as he addressed the commander-in-chief.
"Sir, the Soviet General Secretary is dead. The message said the acting General Secretary implores us to downgrade our alert status. They are de-escalating their military posturing at this time. They want to speak with the President. With you, sir. Immediately."
"Oh, Christ in heaven," Wilkinson exploded.
"The chiefs don't know."
Wilkinson raced down the hallway, almost falling, as he rounded the corner leading to the war room. General Hollingsworth, Marine Corps Commandant, looked at the wall-mounted 24-hour clock, then picked up the red phone.
"Delta One strike. I repeat, Delta One strike. Presidential authority. Launch all missiles. Launch all missiles. Condition One, Sierra. I repeat, Condition One, Sierra. Code Able."
Hollingsworth caught the eye of Admiral Chambers, who nodded yes.
"Authentication," Hollingsworth continued. "Baker, Tango, Victor, One, Niner..."
"Stop, goddammit!"
Wilkinson shouted, gesturing wildly with his arms.
"Cancel the order! Cancel the strike!"
Hollingsworth hesitated a fraction of a second. "I'm comprehending."
"Now!"
Wilkinson yelled.
"Cancel the goddamn strike!"
"Cancel! Cancel!"
Hollingsworth shouted into the phone as the other chief stared in shocked relief. "Cancel the strike. All commands, reply immediately. Repeat, cancel the strike per presidential order." The order to rescind the preemptive nuclear strike against the Soviet Union halted the major missile launches. However, preparatory measures to neutralize Russian submarines, fighter aircraft, bombers, surface ships, and early warning radar installations had commenced 2 minutes before the scheduled strike. A number of skirmishes escalated until the ceasefire order was communicated to on-site commanders. An extreme state of readiness remained in effect for 72 hours. The operative known as Dmitri, along with the crew of Scarecrow 1, auto-rotated onto their rescue ship. The S-70 had run out of fuel as Buchanan slowed to flare the Nighthawk over the ship's deck. The gunship was destroyed, but the crew, along with Dmitri and Steve Wickham, survived.